Good afternoon, everyone. I'm calling a meeting on the Committee of Health and Human Service Policy to order. Okay, is it on? Okay, good. There is a quorum present. May I have a motion to approve the minutes for Tuesday, February the 19th?
So moved.
Representative Albright moves approval of the minutes for Tuesday, February the 19th. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for Tuesday, February the 19th are approved. So, members, today we have four bills to be heard in this committee. I expect that it's possible that we may go past 4:15, our time that is allotted for us here. We have caucus at 4:15. So it is my thought that we will be coming back this evening at the call of the chair. We'll recess and come back into this room after caucus. So I do want to apologize for anyone who traveled here a distance in the snow. It's pretty bad outside. And if at all possible, I would do my best to get as many folks as possible to testify today if you cannot come back. And if you cannot come back, please check in with my CA here, Patrick, and we can see what it is that we can do. And I can't promise anything. It just depends on the bills themselves and how many testifiers and time and processes we take with each bill. So in saying that, our first bill is House File 733 with Representative Kapke. So the chair moves that House File 733 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. We have the bill before the committee. Welcome, Representative Kapke. Can you please present your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I really appreciate your time and for being here today. My first time, so obligatory cookies are coming around. So we can go with that, and we'll keep it short today. So thank you, Chair Moran and members. House File 733 is an initiative of the Minnesota Sheriff's Association to authorize the use of low-dose X-ray body scanning devices for the purpose of scanning incoming inmates to correctional facilities for concealed weapons, drugs, communication devices, and other contraband that pose serious risk to the safety and security of jail staff and inmates. The House of Representatives passed similar language last year and was included in the omnibus bill that was vetoed by Governor Dayton in 2018. There was no opposition to this bill. The language contained in House File 733 is the exact same language contained in the bill vetoed last year. So the Minnesota Department of Health regulates X-ray devices used in Minnesota. Current law appears to limit the use of these scanners to medical settings, and this bill would authorize their use in local and state correctional facilities. So it will help to make sure that we are much safer in our local jails and prisons. And so with me today is Commander Dave Patchell of the Anoka County Sheriff's Office and Warden Tracy Belts from the Shakopee, from my district, from the Shakopee Women's Correctional Facility, and they will testify and answer any questions that we have. And so I also believe, and there are representatives from the Department of Health and the Department of Corrections here. If we have any more technical questions for them, then I am completely unable to answer. So thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much, Representative. To the first testifier, please welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and who you are and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is David Cashel. I am a commander with the Anoka County Sheriff's Office, and I oversee jail operations. We are here to ask for your support on this bill because in local jails and correctional facilities, we are facing a contraband crisis. And that's not a word I use lightly. Contraband has been something we've dealt with ever since there's been jails and prisons, but it has gotten much worse in the last 7 to 10 years. When I first started in this line of work, we would have contraband coming in, but it was relatively infrequently, and the attempts to introduce contraband were not very sophisticated. That has turned around. In the last 9 years, I've seen almost a 400% increase in the amount of drugs I've found in my jail alone. And we are not catching everything. That's the problem. When we first started noticing an uptick in drugs coming into our facility, we started looking at ways we could try and find them. We increased the number of searches. We now do 3 searches when a person comes into custody. Once in the garage to find big contraband. Once again, once they come in the jail, we then do a metal detector search to try and find weapons. And then finally, we do a really close pat search to find items. To help us find drugs that are coming in through the mail or drugs that have gotten into the jail, we use drug dogs to scan our mail and also periodically walk through our facility to find drugs. The problem is we are still finding drugs in our jail. We know through developed intelligence, talking to the people that smuggle them in, the way they're getting it in, and they're getting it in by hiding it inside their body. That is something that none of our current tools will detect or find. The problem with this, not just is that the drugs are coming in, it's the risk it presents. It presents a risk to the person that's smuggling it in, because they usually will ingest it in like a latex balloon or something like that. If that leaks, they will have a horrible time. They could actually die from that, from overdose of drugs. If they get it into the jail and sell it to somebody else, that can cause problems. And if staff come into contact with the item, they can overdose too. In my jail alone in the last 6 months, I've sent 2 people out on red lights and sirens with an ambulance because they managed to overdose once they got in my jail. One of my peers at another correctional facility, 2 of his officers were sent to the hospital because they came across a white powder in the course of their duties, and they were badly affected by it. I'm not aware of any deaths due to this, but it's only a matter of time before we have them. These low-dose ionizing scanners, they're very much similar in many ways to what we walk through when we go to the airport, but they would be a crucial tool for us because they would help us detect items that are hidden internally within a person's body. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Can we give another testifier? Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Tracy Belts. I'm the warden at Shakopee Correctional Facility. Thank you for allowing me to testify. I echo the sentiments that was just expressed. For our department, it would be hugely beneficial to have a scanning device that we could detect contraband that are hidden on or in a person as they come in. We recently had a very similar situation within the last couple of weeks where a woman was sent out to the hospital after exhibiting almost seizure-like kind of behaviors. She had been with us for 3 weeks and was found to be positive on drugs, and if you're in there for 3 weeks, there's only one way you're getting them in, and that's typically smuggling them in inside or on a person. The benefits are not just within the keeping of the safer facility, which is paramount, but we're also concerned about the woman themselves when they have things that are on them or in them that they should not have. We can treat them medically. Right now, it's undetectable. From my personal vantage point, I'm dealing with the only female facility, and we do things a little bit different there. We have, for example, children's visits that they are allowed to come inside the prison. I am concerned about drugs inside of our facilities when I've got kids that are visiting their mom. Additionally, it's a benefit to our staff. That's something that people don't often think about, but staff don't like going through the process of performing an unclothed body search. This equipment, this tool, would give us the opportunity to do the search the way that we need to do it, with them having a gown over them. So working with the female population, there is a huge history of trauma, abuse issues that the women have gone through, and every time you have to do a search like we do, it causes more trauma issues. And so the benefits are all around. Safer facilities, safer for the women themselves, safer for the people that work there. The other big issue is that if we don't have safe prisons, we can't work on our mission to give them programming that helps them get out and stay out. And that is of paramount importance to us. We want to reduce recidivism, and to do that, you have to have a foundation of safe, secure facilities. Keeping contraband out aids in that process. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Warden Belt, for coming out to testify today. Do we have anyone else from the audience who would like to testify in, on House File 733? Okay. Any discussion from the committee? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and this would be for the member from Shakopee. In subdivision 9 of your bill, you talk about an exemption available to the employees of correctional facilities, and you're exempting them from subdivisions 5 and 6, which speak to the training aspect for individuals operating these systems. So what training would they possess that would avail them of understanding how to operate the systems?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Albright. Yeah, this is a very good question, and one that I also asked as we were first talking about this. But there's extensive training, obviously, that needs to go into these types of devices to be used, and a better person to answer that will be from the Health Department. So I would like to call them down to give a clear technical answer that I'm unable to provide.
Hello, and welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Teresa Parrington. I'm the X-ray program supervisor here for the Minnesota Department of Health. To answer the question in regards to the exemption, there is no national recognized guideline standard for these individuals to take a test for training. That's why they're exempt from it. However, there are national recognized guidelines for, that were developed from the Health Physics Society back in 2009 that has numerous amount of training that is required for the individuals who are operating the equipment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm sure that in the context of that training, we're also talking about the safety of the operators, given the fact that there are low doses of X-ray being emitted by these machines on a regular basis, probably per day. And so then my follow-on is, and maybe you can answer this, is under subdivision 9, paragraph B, where you're talking about in lines 2.18, it says permanent rules adopted by the commissioner governing security screening systems. So could you just elaborate for the members of the committee in terms of what that really pertains to?
To the testifier.
Madam Chair, committee members, can you repeat that question? Oh, I want to make sure I'm in the correct area.
I don't have a problem with the language. I just don't understand it. It suggests on line 2.18, this paragraph expires. I'm going up the line above it. Okay. This paragraph expires on December 31st of the year that the permanent rules adopted by the commissioner governing security screening systems is published in the state registrar. What does that mean?
Please proceed.
Okay, Madam Chair, committee members, what I can answer this is currently right now we have rules and regulations that prohibit the use of this use of equipment because our rules were developed and adopted in 2008. Since then, in 2009, Health Physics Society has come out with national recognized guidelines to safely regulate these types of equipment. Currently, right now, there's 13 states that are currently regulating this in the states. What 217 to 219 means is currently right now, our rules don't have anything in there right now to protect these types of equipment. So what we plan to do is utilize a variance to use these national recognized guidelines until our rules are adopted to allow this use of the equipment. There are requirements for the inmates to get scanned to safely use in these national recognized guidelines that limits them to how many times they can actually get scanned. There's also requirements in there that allows for the facilities to give the inmates documentation on what just what kind of screening that they just had. So they're also notifying them as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate the questions from Representative Albright, because this is a health committee. And so while I think the case that was made by the other testifiers is pretty compelling about the need and that there's some health aspects to that too, I really did want to ask about, you know, the safety of this, and especially the warden, Warden Belt said that children might be screened. I think that was what she was saying. No, Representative Tapke, you're shaking your head. That wouldn't be part of it. So, but that was that kind of raised a bit of a red flag for me if children would be going through this equipment. But to the testifier from the Department of Health, it sounds like in the way you answered Representative Albright that there are some rules around this and that the department is really monitoring this for safety. That's really my concern here in the health committee. Is that accurate?
Mrs. Burrington?
Madam Chair, committee members, yes, that is accurate. We intend to use this variance to allow the safe use of this equipment by utilizing the national recognized guidelines that were developed by the Health Physics Society to safely regulate them until our rules are adopted.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Representative Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a question about what kind of equipment we're talking about, because we're trying, you said you'd be able to see inside people's stomachs?
Mrs. Purrington.
Madam Chair, committee members, yes, there are two types of screening systems. One is where you can just get the image on the outside, which is similar to what you would see if you were going through the airport. You would just get to see the surface. These types of equipment that they're referencing actually gets, it's like an x-ray, where if you would get a regular general chest x-ray, you would actually visually be able to see with inside of the body.
Representative Mann.
Okay. But things like a bag of cocaine that has no calcium or no, you know, it's like soft tissue, you can still see that on this particular scan?
Mrs. Burrington.
Madam Chair, committee members, from my understanding, yes.
Representative Elderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Tapke, maybe this is for the Department of Health. So you said there was a limitation on how many times a person can be scanned. I, of course, am always very worried about how much radiation somebody is going to be exposed to. Can you tell me what does that look like, and is there a dose per screen? Every time they're scanned, is there a dose of radiation? I want to know the measurement of what they're actually being exposed to.
Mrs. Burrington.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm just going to grab that information. By looking at the information that I have from these Health Physics Society, one individual can be scanned 2 times per day, 19 times in a week, 83 times in a month, and 1,000 times in 1 year. To answer your question in regards to Milliram, in one day, when I'm referencing the 2 times per day, it is you can receive 1 milliram in one day, which would equal the 2 times a day. When it comes to the 12-month period, it's 25 milliram in a year.
Representative Elvis.
And does that go by with, thank you, Madam Chair, does that go by national standards set within that guideline that you would be falling within that exposure?
Mrs. Perez.
Madam Chair, committee members, yes, it is.
Okay, and can I find that online?
You yes. Think, okay. Well, absolutely. This type of ANSI standard, that you can buy it online for $50.
Okay.
So, yes, it is available online.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is for Warden Belts. I'm wondering if there's a protocol in place if someone declined to be screened. That sounds like a safe level of radiation for a pregnant woman, for example, but if a pregnant woman declined to be screened, do you then offer a manual screening or what goes on?
Warden Bell.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that is an exceptional question that I cannot answer at this time. I would have to consult with we have a Department of Health within our department, and I would have to go to the director and talk to them about what that would look like. We can always revert back to what we do now, which is the unclothed. Yeah.
Thank you. Is there any further questions from members? All right, so being no further discussion, Representative Schultz. Representative Albright. All right.
No, he made the motion.
He moved the motion. Representative Albright, agreed.
Madam Chair, I move for the minutes.
I did that. Okay. We're okay. So, being no further discussion, the chair renews her motion that House File 733 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails, and House File 733 is recommended for referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you all so much. And be safe driving back.
Thank you.
All right. Next bill before the committee is House File 85 for Representative Grant Brand. The chair moves House File 85 to be recommended for placement on the general register. We have the bill before the committee. Welcome, Representative Brand.
Mm-hmm.
Please present your bill.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. I am here to propose legislation in front of the committee today, which was included in the 2018 budget bill. This proposal would direct the State Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board to propose guidelines for EMT, AEMTs, and paramedics to assist a patient in the administration of time-sensitive medication. Although these guidelines are available broadly through the state now, this proposal would work to assure all EMS services had the same guidelines and information across the state. The A2 amendment, which I've also included before you, would remove Section B of the bill that brought concerns for the Minnesota Nurses Association over care planning by EMTs and the skill required to do that. At this point, I've not heard any additional opposition to the bill. And with me today, I've got a couple of people and that I'd also like to have testify.
Before we testify to begin, I need someone to move the A2 author's amendment.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Liebman. All in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed? Any discussion? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Bryant, your amendment has been added on to your original bill.
Thank you.
To the testifier, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about who you are and why you're here today.
Hi, my name is Bailey, and my adrenal glands don't work like other kids. I like horses and American Girl stuff. I have to be careful because if I get hurt or sick, I get a shot, then I go to the hospital.
Can she repeat her name for us? What's your name?
Bailey,
what's your last name?
Johnson.
Welcome, Bailey Johnson. Thank you.
And I'm Bailey's mom. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. Bailey has adrenal insufficiency where her adrenal glands don't produce sufficient amounts of cortisol. Cortisol is the hormone that helps maintain life-sustaining functions such as regulating blood pressure, blood sugar, and heart muscle tone. adrenal insufficiency can occur for a variety of reasons. Bailey's comes from a genetic disease that she had when she was born called congenital adrenal hyperplasia. Bailey was diagnosed when she was just 5 days old. She must take medication several times a day, every single day for the rest of her life. In times of stress, Bailey needs extra cortisol. A stressor for Bailey might be something that we would consider harmless or nuisance, such as strep throat and ear infection, or even if we get a dental filling. Other stressors are dehydration, illness, broken bones, or infections. Without immediate treatment, something as common as vomiting or diarrhea could very quickly trigger an adrenal crisis. Adrenal crisis is life-threatening. It requires immediate treatment in the form of a specific drug that Bailey has with her at all times. Delayed treatment of even as little as 30 minutes could have catastrophic results. When Bailey was diagnosed, we were told by her care team that Minnesota does not have protocols in place to address adrenal insufficiency in emergencies. We are advised to take precautionary measures because a call to 911 didn't necessarily mean that Bailey would get the immediate treatment that she needs. Therefore, we have always been proactive in her care. She wears a medical bracelet. She has a seatbelt cover that contains all of her information. She carries an emergency kit with her wherever she goes. We have medicine in a marked cabinet at home. We have medicine at school, at her dad's work, at my mom's work, in my purse. We have it everywhere at all times. Bailey's brave older brother, who is just 11, knows where Bailey's medicine is, where it's located, and when she needs it. Just this last spring, he had to use that knowledge to help Bailey when she was sick and in the care of somebody else. Bailey's teachers train yearly on how to help Bailey when she is sick. Our address is flagged in the 911 system, and every year we share Bailey's needs with our local fire and rescue. Bailey has an emergency care plan with our local ambulance service, and she has a copy of an emergency letter on file at our local ER. So as you can see, we're prepared as much as we could be, and we felt safe. In the summer of 2016, we had an incident that brought us to realize that we cannot be the only ones equipped to protect Bailey. We went to an outdoor event in very rural Minnesota, and Bailey became sick and was lethargic. We gave her medicine as directed, but she didn't respond like we thought she would. She was in crisis. In a panic and away from home, we asked the ambulance crew that was there to help. We told them what Bailey had, what her needs were, and showed them her emergency care plan. By no fault of their own, they were unable to help and sent us on our way. On that drive home, it became crystal clear to us that all of our preparedness was not enough. We left there knowing that if we had an accident on the way home, that very crew could be the one to come to our aid. We became acutely aware that in any instance, anywhere in the state of Minnesota, if her dad or I were unable to help Bailey, no one might be able to help Bailey. She could die with her specific instructions and her life-saving medications within reach. So despite all of our planning, we do not drop Bailey off at basketball or gymnastics practices like other parents do to run errands. Either her dad or I go on out-of-town field trips. She doesn't even ride a school bus. Birthday parties, play dates, and babysitters are a huge leap of faith. Now Bailey's coming to an age where she wants to be in everything in school, all the extracurriculars, all the sports. She wants it all. We've already had to tell her no because some of it is some things where neither her dad nor I could readily be available for her, just in case. We are thankful for the heroes in our life, like our local fire and rescue in small Cortland, Minnesota, Bailey's teachers at St. Paul's Lutheran School, the Alina Ambulance Service, all of whom recognize the urgent need Bailey has when she's in crisis. We also know that EMS are heroes too. We are asking that you please give these heroes the tools that they need to save people like Bailey in an urgent medical situation. Please give Bailey another set of heroes. Please support Bill HF85.
Madam Chair, members, Buck McAlpin here on behalf of the Minnesota Ambulance Association. We worked last year with the family and Representative Johnson and Senator Frentz over in the Senate on this legislation. It was included in the budget bill that was vetoed. We've done some work on it since then and think it's a better bill, working with some concerns with the nurses and the Emergency Services Regulatory Board on a little provision with care plans, and there was some good feedback. But lots of this is offered around the state today with their ambulances. But we feel, working with our partners at the state EMS board, we can do a better job of making sure everybody in Minnesota, even probably our small rural ambulance services, have access to the same guidelines our big ones like Alina do that you just mentioned a minute ago. So we're in support of the bill, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you so much. Yes, please. Introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Anthony Spector, and I'm the Executive Director of the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board. I'm here to testify that with as the bill is as amended, the EMS Regulatory Board does not oppose and does support the amended bill to move forward. And I'm here to answer any questions.
That is awesome. Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on House File 85? Members, any questions? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the author, to the testifiers on line 1.12, it talks about the intention to treat adrenal insufficiency, but it also includes other rare conditions. And I'm just wondering if either of the two testifiers could just lay out for us maybe the commonality of those ones that might occur in the field.
To, please.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Albright. That came out of concerns from the medical directors and the legal about we just didn't want to focus on one rare condition. There's, I believe, the Atlanta medical director said there could be over 400 of them. So we wanted to be sure that our guidelines focused on not just the adrenal issue, but hemophilia, that the paramedics and EMTs and AMTs were ready to respond to everything.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Edison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So to the mom, when your daughter was having this incident, you were in rural Minnesota. When you went to the EMTs and asked them to help, Representative Tapke, you can jump in if you would like. This law essentially is going to allow them to be able to help you because they said they could not help you with prescriptions. Could you just give me a little bit more information on that?
Mrs. Johnson.
Oh, sorry. We just went to them and asked, you know, if they would review her letter and, you know, let us know if we were doing the right thing because we hadn't had anything like that arise before. And we knew what the plan of action was and we left there. But as we left, we knew that if we were in a car accident, that if they came to our aid, that if they were the ones that showed up and her dad or I couldn't administer her medication, we knew that they probably couldn't either. So Bailey was fine, of course. We where she needed to be, and
does that
answer your question?
Okay, so I guess, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess Representative Tapp, I keep calling you Tapp because I wasn't there. Representative Brand, this law would allow the paramedic then to have a plan for her. Will she also have a card? Is that how? I guess I'm just trying to make sure I understand how it's going to work.
Certainly. So there was, Madam Chair, Representative Edelson, there was some concern about the planning part of it, and so that is not part of this bill. That was the A2 amendment that actually removed that part of this bill. But what it does is it allows us, from the liability standpoint, allows EMS professionals, AMTs, paramedics to actually administer the shot. Because when you think about it, you know, there's this concept of a golden hour. These are golden minutes. And so if this isn't administered right away, it could be tragic.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Chair Liebling.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to say, first of all, Representative Brand, thank you for bringing this bill. I remember it from last year, I think it was. And, you know, it's really unfortunate that it didn't become law. And I just also wanted to remember that this was originally brought by your predecessor, Representative Clark Johnson, and I know that he was, you know, was very, very disappointed that it didn't become law. So I just wanted to say thank you. I think it seems like an entirely reasonable thing to do, and, you know, I appreciate the family, the Johnsons, are willing to come again to get this done. And I think by being here, especially on this very snowy day, that you're helping probably a lot of other families as well. So thank you for bringing this to our attention, and you know, I hope that we can get this done this year.
Any Representative Albright.
Thank you. Bailey, do you wear like a bracelet?
Yes.
And so is that specific to her condition, or does it notify the paramedics of what condition she has, and is that going to be part of the suggestion of how we work out? Because if you or your husband are both incapacitated, such as you described in a car accident, how will they know what to do for Bailey if she's not able to explain herself, or you for her?
Bailey's condition is marked and labeled on her ID bracelet, and then her number of her primary care doctor at her endocrinologist. And then in her bag, she also has an emergency care letter that her endocrinologist wrote up with detailed instructions on how to treat Bailey.
Well, thank you.
Okay. Any further discussion? Okay. Representative Pearson.
Bailey, I just want to say I love your bag.
Thank you.
Did you want one?
All right. So, you know, we always have great testifiers in here, but no one has been any braver than you, Bailey. You came in, you testified, and you just did a great job. I want to thank you for doing that. Very brave of you. So there being no further discussion, the chair renews her motion that House File 85 be recommended for placement on the general register. Thank you so much, and good luck. All those in favor of the motion, the chair renewed motion on House File 85, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? The motion prevailed. Thank you so much. All right. So our next bill, House File 831, Representative Halverson. So again, Chair moves that House File 831 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Judiciary. We have the bill before the committee. Welcome, Representative Halverson. Please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. House File 831 is a bill to update and modernize Minnesota's Health Records Act. The Minnesota Health Records Act was passed many years ago, I want to say in the 80s, and we are in need of an update. It was passed before the days of modern record keeping, electronic medical records, and the restrictions that Minnesota has are restrictions that 48 other states do not have. And so I bring this bill before you with bipartisan support, because this is one of the most important things we could do this year to have an impact on health care costs. One of the biggest impacts of the way that we notice health records and exchange patient data for treatment, for payment, or for health care operations, as we do under HIPAA, having another layer of Minnesota law actually has an impact of having us duplicate treatment on people. One of the examples that I give is that I had a sick child who had to move from one healthcare system to another because there are very few of the pediatric specialists that he needed to see, and after drawing lots of blood from my kid and doing imaging on my kid, we had to go to another healthcare system and do it all over again so that he could get prompt care. That was hard to watch as a parent, and we hear that from patients all the time. Again, my bill only covers treatment, payment, and healthcare operations. So these are activities that are specifically defined under the Federal Privacy Act, HIPAA. It's better known as HIPAA. And these are activities like quality assessment, care management, accreditation of facilities and providers, and then fraud and abuse detection. There's a lot of ways that we communicate through the system to work with patients and make sure that we're providing treatment for patients. I think it's incredibly important to note that the standards of HIPAA are exceptional and are well followed throughout the state of Minnesota. This is not a free-for-all for folks to share data on any single one of us. Data is only shared if it's necessary to facilitate our treatment, if it's necessary to facilitate our payments, if it's necessary to facilitate case management, quality assessment, and those kinds of things. Nobody is going to be able to access your data without the need, and that's one of the standards of HIPAA. It is the minimum necessary when they access data. And the federal law has standards in place to protect patient records. There also is security in place that governs patients' records under the HIPAA Act. There are certain exemptions to the Minnesota Health Records Act, and this simply adds an exception to the law as it is written. And I think that the most important thing to recognize is that this is something that the healthcare system in general has been talking about and looking at for a very long time. There are, I think that there's a letter in your packet, I hope that there is, that shows the support of healthcare groups, healthcare providers, the Minnesota Medical Association, medical equipment services, community health centers, chemical dependency treatment centers, the Brain Injury Alliance, the Chamber of Commerce, the list goes on and on, but it's a very broad group, and I think that any time that an issue brings people together like this for the purpose of serving Minnesotans, that's a really good indication of the need and the necessity of the bill. And that is my introduction to the bill, Madam Chair, and I know that there are a number of people who wish to testify.
Thank you, Representative Havison. We have several individuals who would like to testify. I will call you down in at least in twos. So please state your name and give your testimony. David Thornton and Mark Berman. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Dave Thorson. I'm a family physician at the Entira Clinic in White Bear Lake. I join you today on behalf of the Minnesota Medical Association to offer MMA's strong support of House File 831. As a physician, I've seen firsthand how conflicts between the MHRA and federal standards impede timely, coordinated care, cost-effective care, and actually put patients at risk. I can share some brief scenarios where this happens. Imagine a patient with dementia who was just discharged from a hospital outside of our practice area after being there to stabilize their behavior on medications. They come in to see me. I don't have their records. I don't know what their medications are. And unless they've signed a consent at the facility at the time of discharge and a consent at our facility to obtain those records, we can't get those records, and we have to rely on a demented patient's history or their family's history, which may not be accurate. Mental health care, another area. Medications that psychiatrists are doing, inpatient psychiatry. Patients are hospitalized all over the state, as you're aware. We have teenagers who are suicidal who get hospitalized in Duluth, Minnesota, South Dakota, North Dakota. When they're discharged, we don't get access to their records unless they've signed a release there and a release at our office. Imagine trying to evaluate and treat a patient that comes into your office on psychotropic medications and we don't even know what they're on. Post-hospital follow-up. I had a patient who had angina, heart pain, in northern Minnesota, was hospitalized in Duluth, and because Duluth doesn't know who Entira is, they didn't ask for release of records so they could communicate with Entira. I couldn't get access to her angiogram or any of those things to really help her get the care she needed. These are just three short stories that happen on a daily basis in our practices. Health privacy protections are vital to foster effective physician-patient relationships by ensuring the patients can be candid with their physicians. And physicians take the charge to protect their patients' privacy very seriously. Privacy regulations, however, can erect barriers, as I've discussed, between patients and their physicians and undermine patient care by restricting access to timely and accurate information. Under the MHRA, patient information may not be shared or received by a physician in most circumstances without explicit consent. Although intended to protect patients, in reality, the requirements can often harm patients more than they help, resulting in duplicative tests, as you heard earlier, rescheduled visits, unnecessary delays in treatment, and medication errors. The discrepancy between state and federal privacy protections can delay and complicate patient care. Patients at nearly every point of the healthcare delivery are having their care compromised. These complications are particularly problematic for those patients with complex healthcare needs that go across healthcare delivery systems. Patients with these complex conditions often receive care from physicians in multiple specialties across the state of Minnesota. And because of the different specialties with different healthcare systems that have different electronic health records and do not understand how to get records back to their primary care providers. Even those patients who want and expect their medical records to be available to providers often don't realize the barriers that are being placed on them. I have patients every day saying, what do you mean you don't have that record? What do you mean you can't get that information? How come? In this day of electronic communication, you can't find out what happened to me in Duluth? You know, they don't understand that it is the restrictions of the state that is preventing us from getting that. Similarly, the MHRA as currently constructed, also complicates care in long-term care settings where physicians and social service providers are called on to coordinate a wide variety of services for their patients and clients. The MHRA hinders care coordination by preventing timely information transfer, forcing social service agencies and physicians to focus on administrative tasks at the expense of helping Minnesotans to live well in their homes and communicate. In both of these scenarios and more, the MHRA adds delay and burden to an already complex healthcare system, all to the detriment of patients. House File 831 will address these concerns by incorporating the protections of HIPAA into Minnesota law, modernizing the MHRA to work with the realities of Minnesota healthcare system. If passed, Minnesotans will receive better, coordinated, and safer care while continuing to enjoy the protections of the MHRA and HIPAA and existing data security, transfer, and access protections afforded under federal law. Minnesota physicians are dedicated to providing quality, timely, and respectful care rooted in strong, trusting physician-patient relationships. Our code of ethics compels us to maintain patient privacy, and we take that mandate seriously. House File 831 will allow Minnesota physicians to provide ethical and quality care while reducing outdated and burdensome requirements. The MMA strongly urges the passage of House File 831 to rectify weaknesses in the MHRA that create barriers to timely, coordinated, and cost-effective care. Thank you very much for your time and attention. I'm happy to answer any questions that members may have at this time.
So, Representative Walford.
Well, thank you to the witness. I think the current law actually tries to address the situation. I don't think anyone has a problem about sharing information for the current treatment of the patient. The only limitation in current law for exchanging information for current treatment is within related healthcare entities. And if we were to take that away so that you as a physician could gather and get in access to information from anyone when it's necessary for the current treatment of the patient, would that solve the situation you're in? Right now it's limited to related healthcare entities.
Dr. Thorson.
Madam Chair, when you look at the importance of coordination of care, it goes across multiple agencies, and it goes into past things as well. So we have people with past hospitalizations that impact their current care. So the coordination of care part that HIPAA allows for coordination of care is a broad thing, really helps us do what we need to do to coordinate care for that patient across a continuum of delivery systems.
Madam Chair.
I think the author would like to respond.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just want to be crystal clear that there is nothing in either the federal or the state law that allows anybody to go gathering information. Everything has to meet a need-to-know standard, and I have seen the HIPAA guidebook, and it is thick, and there are every agency, I believe, has attorneys that are helping with the compliance of this very complex law. So you can't go digging for data. You can't go mining for data. You can only get what you need to know to treat the patient in that situation.
Well, thank you. Representative Halverson, I'm just looking at the current language, which says for the current treatment of the patient, which I totally agree, we ought to make sure that the information is available there and without limit based on what entity you're contracted with or anything else. But the House research summary says that if we were to adopt this as broadly as it's drafted, that the information be allowed to go to healthcare clearinghouses, healthcare providers, their business associates, and there's some other material in our packet that defines others other than the people who are actually involved in care. And that, if other witnesses, as they're coming forth, could talk about why do these other business entities need to have access? Because I have seen consultants, when we've seen reports in Minnesota about the unintended potential release of patient information. I can remember one, it was a consultant to a major hospital who's had the information about patients on their laptop, which was stolen from the trunk of their car. And they were doing some kind of research or study. It wasn't related at all to the care of a specific patient, but it required a notification of a lot of patients that private information about them may have gone out. And so I just really like to understand, because I do want to make sure that it's available for treatment. I'm just trying to understand the business associates and what that means.
Okay. Who would like to respond to that?
Well, I can give, I can do the 10,000 feet and then the doctor can give us the day-to-day if that works. But I think you bring up an important point of clarification, Representative Loeffler. Nothing in this bill changes the way that Minnesota protects data for study. And so research is not included in this. It is strictly for treatment, payment, or healthcare operations, which is defined as things like care coordination.
Madam Chair, in most situations, people, when they sign up for insurance, sign an agreement that the insurance company has the ability to get this information. So that is not necessarily a change, because insurance companies have to know what was done in order to make payment for those processes. The incidents that you talked about where there was a theft of a laptop, that's an obvious, a horrible situation to have for patient data. But the person that kept the laptop that did not have an encrypted hard drive on their laptop and things like that, that's an error that's made. It would not change with this new law. It would still be the wrong thing to do. So this law would not allow access for a person to have data on their personal computer that is not protected.
Madam Chair.
Representative Halverson.
I have another person who's here to assist with the technical questions on the bill. I'm happy to say that he was able to come from St. Cloud, and so I wasn't sure if he was going to be able to make it. So if I may introduce him, and he can maybe shed some light as well.
Well, welcome to the committee, and glad you made it here safely. Please introduce yourself and share your
Madam Chair and members, I had to make a decision whether or not to dress for the weather or the hearing. And I chose to dress for the traffic. There was a lot of folks that did make it into the ditch as I passed by. And I thought, I've testified in front of this committee and many, many others. 2 a.m.
Introduce yourself. You
know, Santo Cruz on behalf of CentraCare and the Minnesota Hospital Association.
Thank you.
So for those of you who are new to the legislature, or at least new to having me testify in front of you, this is new for me as well. This is the first time I'll testify without a tie on, probably the only time. But Madam Chair and members, to the question earlier, I believe what's being referred to is the Accretive Health lawsuit, where there was a laptop left in a car that was then taken and then led to a much longer investigation by the Attorney General at the time. And I'm glad it was brought up, because that is precisely what we're here to talk about in terms of the HIPAA standard. To be quite frank with you, is no joke. The lawsuit that went forward on HIPAA standards. And so if you recall, and I didn't represent either party at the time as an attorney or anything like that, I'm going off of memory and court filings. There was many, many counts by the Attorney General that were violated in state law when they brought the Accretive Health complaint on behalf of the people of Minnesota. The vast majority of those claims that moved forward and then led to basically a consent decree by the court for a settlement, that particular consultant would leave the state for a period of time, was on HIPAA and the high-tech standard. When that laptop was in the car, I think it was stolen like July 25th, 2011 or 2012. You can check me on that. When that was stolen, the reason why they got into trouble was because the information from about 23,000 Minnesotans was not encrypted as it's required in the HIPAA standard, not underneath the Minnesota Health Records Act. And the one claim, as I believe that I recall, that the Health Record Act was in the complaint, was that the stealing of it was an unauthorized disclosure that didn't have a signed, written, and dated authorization from 23,000 patients that it could be taken from that car. That's a breach under HIPAA, so it didn't add anything to the claim.
Thank you for that information. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. The question still to me is the business associates and for what purpose they need to know more than the current information. I understand billing information needs to be exchanged, but, you know, business associate can sometimes be broadly interpreted. It can be relationships with pharmaceutical drug salespersons who are tracking things. It can be, I think the concerns that I have heard from people are more about wanting past private medical information being widely available to anyone who has access to their medical record, and concerns about who would have access to the complete medical record, not their current treatment history and bills. They understand there has to be processing done, but I have heard from people who are really concerned that, you know, someone who's treating them for, you know, hammer toes or something doesn't really need to know what their mental health history or drug treatment was in their 20s or something else that they feel is very sensitive and may not have shared with other people in their lives.
So we're going to go to the next testifier. You need to respond.
Madam Chair, I think it's a really important piece of the questions that surround how our data is used, and I think that it would be good to have an understanding to move the discussion forward, if that's all right with you.
The piece that's in discussion right now is Section 1 of Subdivision 5. It's the language in Subdivision 5 of the bill. Please.
So, Madam Chair and members, to address three quick points on that, because I do know that there are people who are scheduled to testify and traveled here as well. First, the BAAs in terms of, you know, the concern, and I think that that's a valid concern that, you're worried that it could be willy-nilly, or how do you wrap your arms around who's a business associate? Under HIPAA, you have to have it documented through a contract. And under the High-Tech Act, which modified HIPAA, not only is a covered entity that is subject to HIPAA responsible for the compliance of HIPAA by contract and by necessary documentation of that, they pass down some of that liability, compliance, and even penalties to their business associates in writing. That business associate has to document that they're well aware of the rules that apply to them, that they will make notifications if there are any breaches, and that they're on the hook if they violate HIPAA. Further, in those circumstances where breaches occur, not only is the business associate now under the federal law on the hook, the covered entity that entered into the contract with them can be held accountable as well, to add an increased incentive for covered entities to take very close looks at the type of relationships and liabilities they're adopting by contract with business associates. You mentioned two other quick things I'll just hit very, very quickly. You talked about, I think you said something like a podiatrist who would hear about mental health or drug treatment. Drug treatment is an entirely separate piece of information governed by 42 CFR Part 2. 42 CFR Part 2 means that any drug treatment information is not affected by anything we're doing today. In fact, it doesn't even live in HIPAA. Treatment information is what we call double top secret under 42 CFR Part 2. A provider that would be seeing someone would not have access, even under HIPAA, to that information about drug treatment or drug assessment if they took a step towards treatment. Mental health, mental health providers themselves have the ability under a separate statute in Minnesota to withhold information if they think that information will be detrimental to the client. So, for example, if a doctor, a podiatrist, I don't know why a podiatrist would request mental health information, but let's say it happened, the provider, the psychiatrist, could then say, under Minnesota law, I can withhold this information from you because I think it would be detrimental to the patient.
Mr. Berman. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I'm here in support of House File 831. I'll tell you a little bit about my background, give you some examples on why I support the bill.
Before you do that, could you please introduce yourself?
Yes, Mark Bierman from Prior Lake. I've lived in the South Metro area for 30 years, where I've maintained my primary health care. After coaching a youth baseball game, my wife said to me, "Something's wrong. You look awkward running, especially when you ran from home plate to the dugout after warming up your pitcher." She said I needed to go see my doctor. So I went to see my doctor, and she ordered a number of tests, which led to a chain of out-of-network specialists, and in turn led to the University of Minnesota, where I was told I had a rare disease, a form of ALS. Unfortunately, a genetic test revealed it was familial, and with two children, I was motivated to fight ALS. That led to a clinical trial through the University of Minnesota's cooperation with San Diego. In fact, I leave Friday in 2 days for my 16th trip since May for another spinal injection. I think it's important to note that because of my background and my primary care in the South Metro area, and with all the specialists I've seen, I've constantly been keeping my primary care providers, the University of Minnesota specialists in the neurology department, and my research in California up to date on all of my medical changes. I said I'd give you a few examples, and I know I'm running late. I'm going to brief over one and just get into the other two. On one of my routine physicals I had, a question came up on a blood test. My doctor looked at it and said she was concerned. I said, "You know, I had a genetic test." And she said, "Oh, really? That would be helpful. Let me see if I can pull it up." She went on the system, I believe it's called Epic, and she saw the data of my test, but she couldn't actually pull the data. And we both were puzzled, and we just chucked it off to a technology glitch and decided to hold off and do a test another day. But after being asked to testify here today, I did some digging and I made some calls to people. I don't even know who I don't talk to anymore, but I was led to believe and wonder if our privacy laws push us to the bottom when new updates come out. Do providers who work for our state and many other states push Minnesota to the bottom because we are an exception? They want to roll out all of their updates, deal with the 48 states that are compliant, and then deal with Minnesota. I also had another issue when I went down to the Mayo Clinic, and my doctor at the University of Minnesota actually was supportive of me to get a second opinion. But before I went down to the Mayo Clinic, I was told by the Mayo I had to hand carry and deliver all of my medical records. They weren't going to accept any electronic format or anything. I had to go out, and it took me forever. Now, as someone who has a rare disease, you seek answers from different specialists, and it took me 2 to 3 weeks. And carrying a stack of paper this big with CDs and everything else to the Mayo Clinic. I was reminded of that just this last week when I reached out and I spoke to a person who was recently diagnosed with ALS, and we talked about a number of different things, and he mentioned something similar, and he said, "Mark, the same thing happened to me." His daughter worked in a medical system not far away, and she said, "I'll help you get into the Mayo Clinic." The Mayo Clinic would not even open up the records because of our privacy laws, and it was so bad, and he was so discouraged, he decided not to seek a second opinion. Finding email. I said I was in San Diego quite often, and my doctor and my research out there are always concerned, and they were concerned about a heart condition that appeared on a record. My doctor said we'd like to have your primary care physician take a look at it and make sure they also agree that it's nothing too serious, but we want to make sure. So I asked my doctor if he could email me the scans. He did. I called my primary care physician and go to the clinic, and they said, no, we can't accept email copies. And I was astonished that in our day and age, I could not email my own medical records to my primary care clinic to have them look at it. And I was left wondering whether or not that was something serious, and if it had been, if our privacy laws would have cost me my life. So I support this bill because, number one, I believe in our legislative process. I advocate for the ALS Association and rare diseases, including my 5 trips to Washington, D.C. I've seen how much analysis and detail is brought into passing laws like HIPAA on a national level. 48 other states have adapted HIPAA as their standard. I'm now experiencing that in another state on the West Coast, and I can see how much easier it is for me to share and to get information from my doctors in California. In the last 10 months, I've talked about this issue with many people, and I cannot think of one person that said that we should be against passing this bill. So in summary, a rare disease has shown me how great our healthcare system in Minnesota can be, but our privacy laws make navigating through our structure very cumbersome. Some just give up. Let's hope it's not life-threatening. You have the power to change this for all Minnesota residents, and I urge you to do the right thing and pass House File 831 and strike that balance that permits important, efficient uses of medical information and allow us to get proper care when we need it most. Thank you.
Thank you. Bentley Graves and Sheila Phelps.
Madam Chair, while they come down,
Representative Halverson.
I just would like to take a moment. I think maybe he's gone, but my co-author, Representative Zerwas, was here. He's carried this bill in the past, and his work on this I just really appreciate. I wanted to highlight that he came in for the hearing as well.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Bentley Graves. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And I appreciate the time to testify today. I appreciate Chair Halverson bringing this important legislation forward. And from the employer perspective, which is the perspective of our members, when it comes to health care issues, cost is very much a top-line issue. And when it comes to efforts to try and take costs out of the system to lower costs for employers and their employees, it's typically a conversation that comes with two very clear sides. You know, somebody asking to take costs out of the system, and that cost coming out of the pocket of somebody at the expense of somebody. What I want to make sure to highlight today is the list of supporters behind this legislation. This is supported by those of us in the business community who represent employers who largely pay the bill for healthcare, but it's also supported by those who work in the healthcare system, doctors, hospitals, health plans. It's also supported by patient advocacy groups, the folks that live every day in the healthcare system. And the reason why is because it's a common sense way to bring costs out of the system, unnecessary costs out of the system, by reducing duplicative tests, medication errors, rescheduled trips, without bringing any harm to the system. And in fact, bringing better care, better coordinated care, better patient outcomes to patients. So I appreciate the opportunity to bring this message of support on behalf of the business community for this legislation that we believe will reduce costs for our members and their employees. But again, does so in a way that brings broader benefits to the entire system. And so I again appreciate Chair Halverson bringing this forward. Appreciate all the work that's gone into this from all the supporters of the bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you so much. For the next guest speaker, please introduce yourself.
Hello, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sheila Van Pelt. Unfortunately, I'm testifying against the bill. And the thing is, I'm just going to say this. There's so many times many of you in here all agree with what this person says, and I'm behind their bill, or I'll agree with this person behind their bill, and this is one that I want to throw the cautionary tale at. This bill really has to do with pride we have in our data practices laws in the state. We are a standout. Much work and has been done through the years by the civil law and data practices as well as judiciary, and you know, it's one I look at and I'm so proud of. What this comes down to is looking between privacy and consent. And the consent part is of utmost importance to many people. Do we have our consent to have our records going around? And the proponents of the bill, and I will look at it. There's so many great things about what the bill does on that, in efficiency and convenience. But what we aren't addressing is the idea of control. Who controls the data? Who gives up the control of their personal, private, most intimate information? And do they want that? Are we taking it away from them, their say? And Representative Loeffler, when she was here, spoke to that, that I'll say thank you. There are costs, some of them intended costs that are there, and unintended costs. And I will say in Europe, many different enactments are being done and taken recently. For instance, in the there's a quote-unquote for an article, the EU hits Google with a fine of $5 billion for pushing apps. And as also in the New York Times, tech giants brace for Europe's new data privacy rules. They're seeing that they need to increase their privacy. And here in the state, we are a leader already. The unintended consequences are the data breaches, and they are real. And in the state, I've heard testifying from our IT departments, it's not a matter if we don't update our data. It's not a matter if that data is going to be breached, but when. And we just can pretty much look every day and find data breaches. And I'm not sure I feel comfortable with every aspect of my personal care being breached and out there. Another area is the Representative Loeffler spoke to was a third-party vendors or bills. Now, it testified last year in a Judiciary Committee was talking about bill collectors. And I believe it was Fairview Systems that was reprimanded for their work done in an unsavory way of harassing patients for collecting bills but having access to information. So with the control in this state, you know, and privacy, I'm going to just throw you on the caveat of things. This seems to be what works for one side more than for the other. In an example of just when we hear the words of leveling the playing field, I look at areas that the provider groups, the HMOs, don't want to give up. They're asking us to give up our most private information. But for example, in this state, we don't even have access to looking at the paid claims data of Medicaid funds in the state to even know what those costs are and if they're accurate. We take people at their word, the HMOs in that matter. Another thing is let's just say now patients are wanting to get access to what are the costs of medical procedures. It's pulling teeth to even know that patients have that right. And lastly, too, in another area, when you want to make a complaint against your HMO provider, that, too, is garnered as being private information you don't get to know. So there seems to be an idea of control that doesn't really work so much in the consumer's end as much as what is being protected and coveted by those who want to maintain control of things that they call secret. Proprietary secret. Also another area I'll just say is PBMs in another cost driver that we don't seem to be looking at. So what I want to look at is when we have transparency and accountability and efficiencies being built into this, we need to look at our system as a whole because there are so many other different drivers into the cost of our health care that isn't being looked at or being cared about. And just really hold tight to people's wish to consent or not consent to their own personal data instead of deciding it for them. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Joseph Olson and David Finwick. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joseph Olson. I'm a professor of law emeritus at Hamline University. I'm here, of course, today speaking on myself alone. When I was in law school, my first semester, we had to write a legal memorandum. It happened to be on informed consent. So I'm one of those people who reads these documents that I'm given whenever I go into one of the medical care providers. And you know what? Every one of them has in this document a consent that makes this law unnecessary. And I read it over, and I go in here, and I find, well, I don't mind if you share it for treatment. Matter of fact, I'd like you to do that. I don't mind if you share it for payment because I'd like my insurance company to pay. But I'm not letting you have it for health care operations because I don't know what health care operations is. And last year, House Research wrote a nice little précis on what's going on here. Here's the paragraph. While it is not known exactly how many entities may have access to a patient's private health information, it is possible to know the types of entities that could potentially have access to it. In general, covered entities and their business associates are permitted to receive it. In 2010, HIPAA issued HIPAA regulations, something rather, and listed more than 700,000 covered entities and 1.5 million business associates. Now, that's almost 10 years ago, so double those numbers. Covered entities include health plans, healthcare providers, healthcare clearinghouses, and when we look into what business associates mean, it includes essentially anyone that a healthcare plan wants to have consultation with, consultation over anything. They can take my data and say, well, we'd like to know, whether fishing increases the likelihood of having heart attacks. Well, they've asked me if I fish. They know I fish. They can take that information and use it. I may not want them to. Personally, I always check no on these things because I feel if somebody's going to get paid for doing research and using me, they can pay me for my sample. Part of that, I suppose, is because when I was at Duke, they were doing open heart operations in the late 60s, and they used whole blood that they took from donors within 2 hours of the operation. And I actually managed to put myself through law school with my right arm. But the fact of the matter is, they already have to ask questions that require them to keep track of data. Here's one place where you can say no, and if you say no, they have to keep track of it. Here's another place where you can say no. If you say no, they have to keep track of it. On the other side, it says, well, if you don't want to give us this information, you can say no, but it doesn't provide any place to do it. And last year we heard testimony that, well, you can't let patients exercise this right of consent because our $400 million computer system can't keep track of it. Well, the fact of the matter is there are patients like me out there who read the forms. There are patients like me out there who say, yes, I'd like you to have the information to treat me. Yes, I'd like you to have the information to get paid from my insurance company. No, I don't want you to have the information for whatever you want to use it for with you and your now half a million unknown entities doing unknown consulting and unknown research about God knows what. Thank God I live in Minnesota. I'm actually able to exercise my right to say no. If I live in another state, I lived under HIPAA, I wouldn't be able to say no. Remember, the bill you're passing says you can't say no. Now, I don't mind that with regard to treatment. I don't mind that with regard to payment. But I certainly do mind it, and I think everyone in Minnesota should mind it, with respect to healthcare operations, because it's just a huge blank check on your most personal, private information. So, what I suggest is you go on page 1, line 13, and you take out or healthcare operations. Because the gentleman over here doesn't care about healthcare operations. He wants his doctor to be able to have information for his treatment. Everyone who testified last year, and there were a lot more people, testified We want, and Zerwas testified to this, we want treatment, we want treatment, we want treatment, we want treatment. Yes, everybody wants treatment. That probably should be taken out. The doctor said, we want to be paid, we want to be paid. Yes, okay, fine. My insurance company will get the information and they'll pay you. But we want to take your information and throw it in the washing machine of research, consulting, selling of this, that, and the other piece of important information. If it's about me, you're going to pay me for selling it, or you're not going to do it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Carrie Sheldon and Phyla Grace. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, thank you. My name is David Feinwax. I am a resident of the city of St. Paul. I teach at the University of Minnesota, but I'm not here speaking on their behalf, for which they are eternally grateful. I am a lawyer, and I was for 30 years general counsel for the Minnesota Hospital Association, and I am here to speak in opposition to this measure, but not because some change isn't needed. As Professor Olson pointed out, for patient convenience, comfort, and effective treatment, some change to Minnesota law probably is justified, but not this. And I'm going to tell you why. The first and most important thing for you to understand is there's a difference between HIPAA and the Minnesota law. The Minnesota law allows you to sue. And if you'll indulge me, in 2009, there was a woman named Candace Yath who went to a clinic operated by Fairview. She made an appointment so that she'd be treated for sexually transmitted disease. The medical assistants who saw Ms. Yath knew her husband. That person read her medical records, learned she had a sexually transmitted disease and a new sex partner other than her husband. She shared that information with other people and with plaintiff's husband, who the woman was separated from. And then someone created a MySpace page posting this information on the internet. Now, that's pretty egregious conduct. In fact, that's pretty crazy. They were sued. Fairview defended this lawsuit on two basic grounds. My favorite, the first defense, is nobody looks at MySpace. And that's probably a good defense. The second defense was that Minnesota's medical record law is preempted by HIPAA, because it is contradictory to and conflicts with HIPAA and is no good. In 2009, the Minnesota Court of Appeals ruled on that and said, no, that is in fact not the case. The Minnesota medical record law is complementary to HIPAA. It augments HIPAA. It helps HIPAA out. It creates yet another reason to keep people honest and to keep information confidential, that reason being that you can sue. You can't sue under HIPAA. There was earlier some discussion about the accretive fiasco, which oddly enough involved Fairview 2 or 3 years later after the Yath case, because apparently the learning curve is steep. So in the accretive case, for which I was present, what happened in the accretive case is accretive was a revenue cycle management company, which is MBA speak for a bill collector. Accretive was given with a HIPAA affiliation agreement the medical records of thousands of patients. I'm not talking about their name, address, and phone number and how much money they owed. I'm talking about their diagnosis, the drugs they were on, what was wrong with them, whether they had chemical dependency issues, whether they suffered from depression, whether they were being treated for sexually transmitted diseases such as HIV or other things. Okay? Accretive used that because they had algorithms designed to pressure people. Our attorney general at the time ran Accretive out of the state, and Accretive paid some number of millions of dollars to the people that they had victimized. This was accomplished not using HIPAA, because under HIPAA you can't sue. This was done using the Minnesota law that you're now being asked to change. And this is, in fact, an incredibly bad idea. We have computers that can keep track of who consents and who doesn't. And last year, this issue has arisen every year, almost since 2009, because the people who don't like this law, and I'm not talking about the poor patients and the other people, the medical providers who don't like this law really don't like the part that allows them to be sued. That's understandable. But it's that part that keeps people honest. It's that part that makes the system work. And as you can see, weird things happen. So, it's your information. It doesn't belong to them. If you want it kept secret, you should have the right to have it kept confidential. If they breach that, you should have a remedy against them. If you want to change the law to allow it to be moved for treatment or payment, that might be okay, but payment has to be bifurcated, because I would defy, and I say that in the most respectful manner, any member of this committee to tell me why a bill collector company needs to have a patient's medical record, their drugs, their diagnosis, and their family history. So there is a way to fix it, but this isn't it. My recommendation would be that this thing be laid over until the Data Practices Committee that heard and considered this last year can come up with what I believe will be close to what I am just suggesting to you. So, yes, there is a fix. And finally, I will leave you with this. All of you have sat on different committees, and you know we are in the midst of an opioid crisis, a terrible dilemma. And we need people into treatment. That's why we're trying to raise money, and we're trying to figure out what we're going to tax. We need to get people to receive treatment. Do you think they're more likely or less likely to get treatment if that information gets posted on MySpace with HIPAA affiliation agreements? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Feinbach. Chair Moran had to step aside, so I'm, as Vice Chair, I'm stepping in. Mr. Cruz?
Thank you again for the record. Santo Cruz, MHA, and CenterCare today. Just to clarify 3 points real quick, we are not amending the private right of action. The lawsuit stays. So if you read the bill, to the last testifier's point about the Minnesota law maintaining an ability to sue, that does not change. So that it will still be a feature of our state law. I would just ask you to do your own internet research on the accretive issue. I don't represent Fairview. I've never worked for them. But you can look for yourself. There's a public complaint from our AG. Again, as I said earlier, the vast majority of that lawsuit was HIPAA. There was one thing that was the Health Records Act, and that was limited to, again, the 23,000 folks who sadly had their information stolen out of a laptop, did not sign a dated release for that to be stolen out of the backseat of the car, which is already captured by the breach definition on the federal level for HIPAA. So again, it didn't add anything to that scenario. And then lastly, about the opioid crisis. Again, I would ask you just to write down this jargon, 42 CFR Part 2. Anything we do here today is not going to affect how treatment information is shared. That is separately regulated at the federal level. We are absolutely required to follow that in Minnesota. And when it comes to drug treatment, it's not even in scope of what we're talking about. And then lastly, to the earlier testifier about what is business operations, it's one page I have in my back pocket. You can find it online. It's not an open book. It's very specific, and I would refer you to the definition on the Federal Register of what business operations are, and they're all predicated upon some other necessary process and other permitted use. This is not to vouch for or say that breaches don't happen. This is to say that there's adequate accountability in place for when breaches do. You can't pass a law that says breaches shall not happen. You can only pass a law that says when they do, what will happen. And people need to be held to account. The stories that have been told are horrific. And people were held to account, as I understand it. Maybe not to the level they ought to have been, maybe not to the satisfaction of those involved, but there was a framework for accountability. I don't think there's any law that we can pass here today or that you all can pass here today that will make hackers stop trying to hack into IT, make people, bad actors, stop existing. It's about the accountability for when those things tragically do happen.
Thank you, Mr. Cruz. For our next testifier, please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Twyla Braze. I am president and co-founder of Citizens Council for Health Freedom. I'm also a registered nurse and a public health nurse. And our organization has long been involved in protecting privacy and consent rights here and at the national level. We have three documents for you, which are going to be handed out shortly. One of them is the Mayo Notice of Privacy Practices, which I will discuss in a moment. One, the other is a definition sheet for those three terms, payment, treatment, healthcare operations, so you will be able to see for yourself the definitions. And then the last one are two local consent forms that have concerned us about how the Minnesota law here is actually being followed or not. So, and I also have five items for your consideration of House File 831. So here's the first item. The first item is that HIPAA is not a privacy rule. It is described as a permissive rule because in most cases, those who hold patient data, called covered entities, are permitted to share and use individually identifiable patient data without patient consent, unless a more protective state law exists, as it does in Minnesota. As David Braler, the first national coordinator of health information technology, said about HIPAA, he said, "You can't force a covered entity to give your data to someone you choose, and you can't stop them from giving it to someone they choose," end quote. Under HIPAA, according to HHS, at least 2.2 million entities can potentially share and use patient identifiable data without patient consent, and that does not include government agencies. So the number is even greater. The second item, privacy rights are humane and compassionate. The pledge to keep a patient's information confidential goes all the way back to the Hippocratic Oath. Privacy rights shield patients when they are vulnerable and gives them the trust they need to speak frankly and access care timely. Privacy rights protect those with mental health issues, sexually transmitted diseases, addictions, cancer, infertility, and disabling genetic conditions. Privacy rights protect reputations, family relationships, and employment, and future aspirations. Minnesota's consent law honors the patient's privacy rights. HIPAA does not. HIPAA allows broad health information exchange, essentially putting it and making your information available through the internet. Consider that the Minnesota Health Information Exchange Law has a clinical data registry. Look up the definition once. What it does is pull all your data together into one single view, one unified record for every individual. Under HIPAA, or under this bill, all that data would become available electronically to anyone the covered entities wanted to give it to. It wouldn't be segmented out. It would be the entire record. That's why a physical therapist called me once and said, you know, I know my patients, I can see their STDs, I can see all this sort of thing, and I know they wouldn't want me to do that, but I can. And so this is what can happen once we move to the HIPAA no privacy standard rather than the Minnesota privacy standard. The third item, the Minnesota legislature used HIPAA's state preemption provision to establish a better than HIPAA law, a real privacy law that requires consent in eight areas. So if you're looking at the Mayo Notice of Privacy Practices, you will see red versus green. And in the red are eight provisions where consent is required in Minnesota, and it is not required around the rest of the nation. All of that would be gone if this bill passes. This bill would undo our best in the nation, better than HIPAA law, and subject all Minnesotans to HIPAA's no privacy rule, giving outsiders a license to intrude. Specifically, House File 831 eliminates consent requirements for treatment, payment, and healthcare operations. So now you all have the definitions sitting in front of you, and I just request that you look particularly at healthcare operations. It is a nearly 400-word list of at least 65 non-clinical business activities, and it could be more depending on how you count it. Even the Minnesota Department of Health admits that eliminating our current consent requirements, quote, may raise privacy concerns because of the broad scope of healthcare operations, end quote. Fourth, consider United Health Group's Optum Insights Division, which has been described as a data and analytics, technology services, and healthcare operations business. Its 2007 revenues were $8.1 billion. No wonder corporate supporters of this bill want to exempt healthcare operations from consent requirements. There is much money to be made. And
those who healthcare corporations using the coercive consent forms like the ones that we have shared with you today, they would probably want this bill passed just to avoid being sued for violating our law. Because if you look at those forms, you'll see, for instance, North Memorial's form, where it says at the bottom, there's only one signature, and all it says is, not only do I agree to consent for treatment, but I agree to all the rest. And there's no chance to cross out all the rest. So that's coercive, and our law is about consent, and consent is not coercion. So, finally, protecting patient privacy protects patient control. In short, he who holds the data makes the rules. Using confidential patient data, payers can profile doctors, track and conduct predictive analytics on patients, intrude in private lives, and use the patient's data against them and the doctors. Therefore, we respectfully ask you to vote no on House File 831. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much. Do we have anyone else in the audience who have traveled from a distance who would like to testify on House File 831? Okay. We only have this room until 4:15, so we'll have to leave. But if members have some questions that we can maybe get through a couple of questions before we recess until the call of the chair, Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We had some back and forth on this question of a private right of action, and I was whispering here with Ms. Clarkvist about that, and I wonder if she could give us try to answer that or address that question for us as best she can, because I think it is kind of a critical issue to this.
So, Madam Chair and members, I guess what I would say is the private right of action is maintained related to the Minnesota Health Records Act. With the amendment to the Health Records Act in this bill, though, there wouldn't be a cause of action for not obtaining consent, because consent isn't required for the release for purposes for treatment, payment, or health care operations. That's helpful.
Okay.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. So, I mean, what I take from that is that Mr. Feinwachs is essentially correct, that your right to sue for dissemination without consent for treatment, for payment, for healthcare operations, whatever that means or doesn't mean, that would be essentially removed by this bill. So, you know, I think that is true. I mean, be out of the room in 5 minutes. I assume we're going to vote on the bill before we leave here at
that would be
5 minutes.
We can do that.
So I just want to make a brief statement here. I've been long opposed to, I was opposed to the previous version of this bill that simply got rid of the Minnesota Health Records Act and had it all be HIPAA. And I think we're moving in the better direction here. I'm not opposed to any change to the Health Records Act, but I do think that what's being asked for here, for my sense of this, it does go too far. The author of the bill made a comment that there's a need to know standard, but I would say to members, which needs and whose needs are being considered here? I think that I recognize that having to ask for consent can sometimes be inconvenient. I think we've made some changes to this law over the years. I think I was here when some of these exceptions were put into the law, exactly because of the kinds of concerns that have been raised here by doctors and patients about wanting to be able to get treatment and not having our consent laws get in the way of treatment. And so I'm all for that. But the gentleman that spoke, Mr. Olson, Professor Olson, I think expressed it pretty well how I feel about this. I get most of my care at the Mayo Clinic, and they have a kiosk now. You don't even have paper anymore. You sign in at the kiosk and they ask you for your consent. And I just don't really see that that's such a big barrier anymore. I also wanted to flag for members, I have an article here which I'm not handing out, but perhaps I will in the next committee, but very recent study from, it's in the Milbank Quarterly, which is a very scholarly journal, just published at the end of 2018, and it talks about how there aren't just one of the policy points they have on the front says, healthcare providers' complaints about legal obstacles to health information exchange may be better understood as reflecting concerns about the economic and competitive risks of information sharing. In other words, you know, there may be, I certainly don't discount the concerns of the large organizations who want it to be cheaper and easier to do their business. I mean, that is a concern, and that's what they're saying here. But the actual issue about treatment or being able to do the business of healthcare is actually less of a concern than it's made out to be when this bill is brought forward. So I am certainly remaining a no on it at this point, and I just wanted to explain that. And if somebody comes forward and makes it easier to exchange information for treatment purposes, I'm all for that. But I don't think it's so difficult right now to I just don't think we need to go the route of allowing information without consent for treatment, payment, or healthcare operations. That just seems to me to be a bridge too far. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Really quick, Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be quick.
We have 3 minutes.
Thank you, Representative Halverson, for bringing this bill forward. As a physician, I think it's an excellent bill, and I think it's a change that we need to make. I can tell you that it is a I also take, as Ms. Van Pelt said, take great pride in the fact that I believe it was Senator Limmer who originally did the Minnesota Health Records Act, and we should be proud of that in Minnesota. But it's become redundant with the changes of HIPAA, and it absolutely acts as a barrier to patient care in my experience as a provider. So I will be a yes on this, and I hope everyone else will be too. Thank you.
In saying that, you know, personally, I remember those days of having to go from one location to manually pick up your medical records and take them from place to place. I thought it was a headache then. I think it was a headache now. I appreciate going into the office, and my medical doctor can see my information from 5 years ago, 10 years ago, and it's available and it's there. You know, one of the things that I have not seen in the testimonies, I know we have fears about privacy, and I think we all know that privacy is hugely important, is that that there's not been any violation under the HIPAA laws. I have not heard that. You know, yes, we heard of a computer that was stolen out of someone's vehicle, and that's, as you stated before, it's not so much under the regulations of HIPAA that was in fault. I believe that's what I heard from you. You know, this is one of these bills that can be very controversial, that we can really have our fears come to a level of, you know, our decision making, whether or not we believe that, you know, Minnesota is one of a few states that have this extra step in the way that gets in the way of hospitals and doctors doing their work. And so I'm going to end by just opening this up for a vote. There's no further discussion. I would like to renew my motion that House File 831 be recommended for referral to the Committee on Judiciary. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. House File 831 is recommended for referral to the Committee on Judiciary. We are adjourned. I'm sorry. I take back that. We are in recess to the call of the chair.
Even our drug companies, in terms of their market power, as was noted also, the PBMs have used their market power to, they'll give us bigger discounts every year, but they also charge. It's resulted in a marketplace that charges a higher price up front. So tell me how much discount you want, and I'll tell you what the price is. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the way the market operates these days. So it doesn't, percent discounts really don't bring about savings in the marketplace. PBMs, a part of this bill is licensing PBMs and providing an oversight process for their business practices. Right now, there's really no federal or state agency that provides oversight. The only recourse someone has if they feel aggrieved by the PBMs and their practices is to file an litigation against them, and it indeed would be many little Davids against three big Goliaths who usually work together even in fighting lawsuits. So oversight of their business practices is critical. Also, there's talk about, and there is a provision to require a fiduciary role or responsibility for PBMs. Fiduciary role here for PBMs would simply mean acting in the best interest of the payer, that is the plan sponsor and the patient. So if they don't want to do that, it means they want to continue to not act in the best interest of the plan sponsor and the patient. And in fact, you know, the talk is, you know, if you pass this bill, we'll raise the cost. Well, wait a minute. If we pass the bill and you have a fiduciary responsibility and you're going to raise the cost, that seems contrary to what the bill's telling us we should be doing. So, in fact, maybe we really do need a bill that does put some fiduciary responsibility. I would point out that most plan sponsors in the commercial market, whether they're commercial or self-insured or ERISA plans, have a fiduciary responsibility for the resources they spend and that their beneficiaries spend. They have the fiduciary responsibility. And in contracting with a PBM to carry out the delivery of the pharmacy benefit, that plan sponsor is obligated to find vendors that will work with them to serve that fiduciary role. And so again, here we have PBMs saying, well, we don't want that responsibility, but the plan sponsor has that and can't delegate or give away that responsibility unless the vendor is willing to be a plan sponsor. I'm familiar with plan sponsors in Minnesota who have put out RFPs asking for PBMs that would accept some fiduciary responsibility in serving their contracts. And some of those plan sponsors didn't have any PBMs bid on the business. Others were told, we can't do that unless we can define fiduciary the way we want to define it rather than the way you want to define it. So you'll hear the PBMs tell us that it's the plan sponsors who set the contracts and all the rules. But again, we have three big players against, there's no single plan sponsor that's anywhere near the market share of any of the PBMs, and it's hard for them to leverage conditions and contracts out of the PBMs. The PBMs, when they're negotiating contracts with a plan sponsor, will tell them, sure, we can be flexible, we can do about anything you want, and then after the contract's signed and they review it, then the plan sponsor finds out, oh, well, we can do that, but it's going to cost you more. We'll have to charge you a fee for this, a fee for that, other fees of various types. I noted I was reading the material here by the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and it, I think, reasonably closely reports that in 2016, brand name prices increased by 9.2%. But they go on to say, but net pharmacy benefit manager customer prices only grew 3.5%, and it says thanks to the results of negotiated savings. Actually, that's primarily due to generics, and that's primarily due to generics that in many cases the PBM has actually even inflated and added a spread onto, as we saw in Ohio, we've seen in Kentucky, I've seen with commercial plans in the state of Minnesota, the same type of spread add-on. So it's really, it would be even better than 3.5% increase if the PBM hadn't added on to the generic cost. So it's due to generics, not necessarily the negotiations of the PBM with the brand name companies per se. And then the description from the Chamber of Commerce also addresses the issue of mail order and specialty pharmacies. These are pharmacies that are in most cases owned by the PBM and that are out there competing with the pharmacy that the PBM is reviewing their prescriptions and adjudicating them and telling the pharmacy, oh, we won't pay you that much. We're gonna pay you less than that. But that same PBM may turn around and pay their own mail order or their own specialty pharmacy a higher price than what they would pay the community pharmacy. This really effectively drives community pharmacies out of the market and concentrates the volume of business that the PBM controls as prescriptions delivered even more and gives them even more market power and market concentration that can be used to raise prices rather than to lower prices. Again, I'm familiar with employers, plan sponsors, that have asked for contracts from PBMs that specify that the PBM will pay no more to their own mail order or specialty pharmacy or their preferred network of pharmacies than they would pay to any other community pharmacy. In some cases, PBMs have refused to do that. In other cases, I've seen the contracts be signed, and then when one examines the data later on, we find that for some drugs, the PBM is paying their mail order more than they pay the community pharmacy. The PBM is paying their specialty more, or they're paying their network of pharmacies more than they pay community pharmacies. So that's not serving the best interests of the plan sponsor or the patient, but that's using the market power of the PBM. The purpose of this isn't to eliminate PBMs, but to have a process for licensure, for oversight of the business, and for assuring reasonable business practices that serve the interests of plan sponsors and patients. And don't forget that the state of Minnesota is a plan sponsor for Medicaid, a plan sponsor for Minnesota employees, a plan sponsor for the exchanges. This has a big impact on funds that you control and allocate at the legislature also, and that continue to grow uncontrollably.
Thank you. Dr. Schoendemeyer, you make some really strong statements. And I guess because I haven't done my homework, is that you are absolutely sure that the statements that you make are factual?
Yes, ma'am.
Right? And it's something that you are sharing with us that we really need to take heed to, how we have PBMs, which with all the words you use, I use words like greed, I heard a threat in there that says if you pass a bill, we want to increase prices, and they're running a market on the backs of, like, individuals and patients, right, like real people who are sick,
mm-hmm,
which is kind of really hard to, you know, want to receive. But I just wanted to get some verification that what you are saying, this is verifiable, and you're not just making things up. This is... As that what you bring to this table around your expertise is built on knowledge and expertise.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I am here to tell you that these are all based on actual data and experiences and contracts and claims that I've seen and analysis I've done in the marketplace nationally and in the marketplace in Minnesota specifically.
All right, thank you for that. I represent you, Martha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Schoendemeyer, thank you for your testimony this evening and some of the perspective that you're able to bring, especially on the national basis. And I'm just wondering, when you look at the national picture and what's been going on here, what's happened or what is happening with other states or other entities that have been making PBMs fiduciaries and how that's been working?
Well, there are other states that are beginning to license PBMs and give them roles. I don't recall I don't track daily all the other states. I don't recall other states that have made them fiduciaries yet, although there was a ruling in Minnesota federal courts that said that with ERISA plans, that if a PBM contracts with an ERISA plan, because that ERISA plan is by law a fiduciary, and anybody they contract with has to help facilitate that role, that by implication, a district court in Minnesota, federal district court in Minnesota, has ruled that PBMs do have a fiduciary responsibility through that ERISA responsibility.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Schoendemeyer, thank you. I thought that Maryland had put together a similar proposal for this.
Dr. Schoendemeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. They may have. I haven't studied their experience yet. A lot of these are very new in their activities. I find it amusing that businesses who serve people spending a lot of money on health care say, we don't want to help you use your money wisely. I just I don't understand a business that would say, we don't want you to use your money wisely. We want to help you spend more of it on us. I realize I'm not against the market or profit or all those other things, but profit's usually made under rules where it serves the interests of both parties, the one paying and the one receiving the benefit. And so I will be watching other states and their experience, but it's this type of provision is fairly new in terms of state statutes. There are other private contracts. I'm aware of private contracts where individual plan sponsors have contracts and PBMs have agreed to be a fiduciary in some cases. And when the PBM does things that are contrary to the plan sponsor's interests, the plan sponsor has been able to file a complaint or a grievance and collect back on that.
Representative Schumacher. Yeah,
thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Oh, okay, Representative Mann.
And also, Nevada is one of the states that passed a law that requires the PBM to have a fiduciary duty. Maine was another one, and they were both upheld in court. D.C. passed one, and that one was not upheld in court.
Thank you. Chair Liebling?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to say, Dr. Schondelmeyer, I know that I really appreciate your coming and bringing your expertise to us here. And I think what is maybe what the chair was kind of reflecting on is that it's so shocking to really hear and learn what these organizations are doing. I mean, you know, I've been here, you know, 14 plus years in the legislature, and I know Representative Rand's been here, what, maybe 10 or 9 or 8, something like that. Anyway, we've been on committees together for a long time, and, you know, always wrestling with kind of the same problems, and really never understanding how this is operating. And even now, it's pretty confusing, you know, It's really is kind of shocking to realize that this has been kind of going on under all our noses. And to finally get to the point to say, we've got to do something about this. We've got to get our arms around this because this is not serving people. I mean, you know, the problem of increasing costs of pharmaceuticals has been going on for a while. And states are struggling with how to get our arms around this. And obviously, you know, this is only one piece of the puzzle, but it sure seems like a big piece. And I really appreciate your being willing to come down here and stick around on a snowy evening and stuff to help inform us about this. And the other committee that you gave a large presentation, I think that was in the Finance Committee. You know, this is something that members really need to start understanding. And it is shocking, but it's shocking not because it's so shocking it is hard to believe. But yet, this is, you know, but as I think Representative Mann started out saying, there are billions of dollars that are being earned by these companies. And there are three big ones. And this is a real thing. And there is a reason that they're making money hand over fist. And consumers, on the other hand, are struggling to be able to pay for drugs that they cannot live without, literally cannot live without. And there's a real disconnect here. And so I really appreciate, Representative Mann, that you've been willing to take this on, and Dr. Schondelmeyer for coming here and helping us out.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mann, you and I shared a conversation yesterday about this issue of fiduciary, and to Dr. Schondelmeyer, I served as a fiduciary for about 20 years to various ERISA plans. And so what you're talking about is a section of ERISA under Section 3, but there are clarifications inside of Section 3, whether or not you're a 316, a 321, or a 338. And there are very, very clear delineations in terms of which type of a fiduciary you are. They all fall under the umbrella of what is commonly referred to as an employee plan. But there are a number of plans that are not qualified plans. There are non-qualified plans in the healthcare industry, much like there are in the retirement sector. So I think I would urge all of us, and I know that you have undertaken a a process of listening, and I appreciate that. And this bill has a number of additional steps, but I do think that there is a great need for further clarification with regard to the type and the breadth of a fiduciary that you are looking to identify within this, in the context of this this bill. Let me back up and just give you a little more context in terms of, in the financial services area, why fiduciaries came about. Fiduciaries are really an extension of the trustees for these programs, enacted or delegated with the responsibility of either having direct discretion to the power to manage, or as an opportunity to be designated to appropriate and make decisions on behalf of a larger group. So this happened over the course of 15 or 20 years in the financial services industry. It was the last thing to happen. What happened before that actually was a consumer-driven effort to find out, what am I paying for and where is it coming from? And so particularly with, we have now a financial services industry that dedicates enormous amounts of time and effort to qualified retirement programs. And I think there is a good similarity to draw to, where you used to have a full service brokerage house handling retirement programs, and that's all you took. And then people started to, as participants, ask the trustees, what am I getting for that brokerage service? And so momentum started to build. And so then you started to identify that these trading platforms, whether it be Schwab, Fidelity, Northern Trust, or any number of other ones, that were pooling all these monies together for the benefit of the mutual funds. And then they were collecting such things as the sub-agent transfer fees, the revenue sharing, the 12B1 fees, B2s, B4s, B6s, depending upon the share class. And I think what you are looking at is the end result rather than where you really want to start. And where I think you should start is addressing and identifying the cash flows and the transparency of the cash flows. Because at the outset of why that causes, because trustees started to get nervous about, well, we don't know. And much like the plans may trust PBMs or any a number of the other players, their coalitions to these, I think your intentions are well-meaning, but I think we're looking at the fiduciary before you actually find the cash flows, which I think should be addressed first and identify those. So to the extent that we can continue the conversation, which I think we shared we'd like to do that, I think there is room to make this a stronger for the sake of the people who are served by it. So really not a question in there, it's more of an observation, and you and I talked and we wanted to share this. So thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, I can hear a question in there. Do we have any other questions? We're going to move forward with the testifiers. Jessica Aitstrup. Please, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Absolutely. Good evening, members of the committee and Madam Chair. My name is Jessica Aitstrup Arrett, and I'm a pharmacist and third-generation owner of Aitstrup Companies. Our family operates 17 retail pharmacies, 4 long-term care pharmacies, and a specialty or infusion pharmacy in central and southern Minnesota. I serve as a board member and work as a staff pharmacist in our retail locations, primarily in Northfield and Faribault. Sterling was founded by my grandfather in 1952. He came to Austin, Minnesota from North Dakota to open a Walgreens agency store. He had $11 in his pocket and no connection to this area of rural Minnesota. The first banker that he met with denied him a loan, but the second banker liked him and helped him finance his first store. After a ton of hustle, relationship building, and mentorship, my grandpa grew a successful business that remains a staple in our small town. My grandpa passed away in 2014, but he was always proud that the only loan he ever took was to open that first store. He was able to build his business by providing expertise to his patients, engaging with his community, and consistently offering a high level of customer service that went beyond the competition. He was even known for delivering prescriptions via snowmobile when the local roads weren't passable and visiting patients in the hospital when they couldn't visit him in the store. Times have changed. Our industry has become so complicated with so many entities involved, including pharmacy benefit managers, who make it increasingly difficult for our independent, family-owned business to survive. Community engagement, excellent patient care, and healthy business practices are no longer a recipe for success in independent community pharmacy. We can earn new patients, take excellent care of them, build trust, and then be told the next day we can't fill their prescriptions. We can provide hours of counseling, visit patients in their homes to ensure proper medication use, help them navigate open enrollment for Medicare and commercial insurance plans, and communicate with their physicians and insurance companies, but we're not compensated for these services. We're forced to operate on narrower margins every single year while providing additional services. I thought it would be a good idea to come armed with a few specific examples of how pharmacy benefit managers have made it more difficult for my patients to receive the care that they need at a cost they can afford, and how PBMs have made it more difficult for our family to operate our mostly rural community pharmacies. These are real patients who have real consequences to their health. First, this one is all too common. I was recently working with a patient who was having trouble affording his copays. We sat down, we looked at costs, we looked at what he was paying. He had a specific generic medication, and he was stretching his 30-day prescription to almost 60 days. So he was taking his medication every other day because he couldn't afford the copay. We identified that this generic medication cost my pharmacy about $13. His insurance plan was charging him a copay, flat copay of $75. The average prescription margin isn't anywhere near that. Most prescriptions we make $10 to $14, so this spread isn't actually coming back to the pharmacy. The bigger concern is that gag clauses in our PBM contracts prevent us from even disclosing this discrepancy to the patient. So I can't tell the patient my cost and their copay and that difference and offer them a less expensive option. So the patient pays $75 for a $13 drug, and I, as a business owner, should probably jump for joy. I'm making this great margin. However, the way it works is that 6 months after that claim is adjudicated, the PBM takes back all but $8, $10, or $12, depending on the claim. And so the patient pays more, the pharmacy can't cover their costs, and the PBM fills their pockets. It's a really complicated cash flow. Nobody quite understands it. There's a huge delay of 6 months that makes it really hard to drill down at the claim level. But ultimately, that's the patient who's paying way more than they should for the prescription. Secondly, I have a patient with early onset dementia. He came to me crying 2 years ago after he first heard his diagnosis. He's a well-educated, super fit guy, tons of hobbies, has a lot of life to live. But he, on that day, was afraid that his wife wouldn't be able to manage his medications as his disease progressed. We started working with him and his wife to proactively address his medication needs. We now package his medications in multi-dose packaging and work directly with his care providers to keep up with dose adjustments, work around his hospitalizations, etc. Fast forward 18 months, this patient called me on my cell phone while I was on vacation, and I'll never forget this phone call. He was having a really bad day and became concerned about the future of Sterling, our pharmacy, his pharmacy. He said he didn't know where he and his wife would turn for care if he no longer had us. We know him by name, even when he doesn't know us, which happens more frequently now. We know his families, his doctors, we know his past. He trusts us. I assured him that we weren't going anywhere, despite the increasing challenges we face every year. However, in the back of my mind, I know that with one wrong decision in plan selection or one change in his PBM, I could lose the ability to care for this patient. I worry as a healthcare professional, but also just as a human, that this patient may lose the high level of care that we've been providing. All of this planning and coordination with patients is what fills my cup as a pharmacist, but unfortunately, it isn't what keeps the lights on. The reimbursement on this patient's medication does not cover the cost of the time it takes my team to meet his needs, and yet the reimbursement continues to decline. Patients are not one-size-fits-all, and neither are pharmacies. Some pharmacies strive to offer high-touch services that meet the needs of more complex patients. These services keep patients out of the hospital, and they position pharmacists to be valuable members of the patient's care team. Patients deserve a choice when it comes to pharmacies, and pharmacies deserve fair compensation for helping to manage patients' health. Next, another one that occurs too often is patients being required to change medications. And I think Representative Mann kind of mentioned this before. Even if a patient is well established on a product that works for them, sometimes the PBM tells them they have to change. So in this particular case, we weren't able to use a prior authorization, which you maybe hear of sometimes. It's a back and forth between the pharmacy and the physician and the insurance company to get a prescription that's not on formulary covered. Sometimes we can go back and forth and make that happen, but it's a headache for sure. In this case, I have a patient, older patient, who's on an inhaler for COPD. If you guys aren't familiar, many inhalers come with different devices. Some of them are the classic puffers that we see and we think of with inhalers. Others you have to cock and twist and open a foil pack, and the person actually has to breathe in the medication. So these devices vary a lot. For this particular patient, the year changed, 2018 to 2019. That was the only difference. With that change came a change in formulary, and this patient's inhaler was no longer covered. So this patient came into the pharmacy to pick it up like they always do, and we said, oh, you know, we had to change you to this new medication because your insurance is no longer covering that one, and we couldn't get it approved. So the patient was really nervous because without this medication, she ends up in the emergency room. If she doesn't get the medication delivered to her lungs like it's supposed to, she cannot breathe. So the patient was scared. Our pharmacist stepped in, educated her on the new device, eased her fears. But why was this necessary when the original product was actually slightly less expensive and worked well for the patient? So now I have PBMs in my pharmacy and in their physician's office making medical decisions for patients whom they've never met. Lastly, one of our pharmacies received a call from a PBM that we're all familiar with to have us reverse a claim because the PBM's own mail order pharmacy was attempting to fill it. We called our patient to discuss before transferring the prescription to them. She stated that she didn't send them the prescription. She doesn't even know who or what this pharmacy is. They had simply intercepted it based on other data that they have and tried to steer it to themselves. We encounter this business practice, sometimes called prescription trolling, time and time again because of the placement of PBMs in the transaction chain. One common perspective is that prescription trolling or other steering of prescriptions to specific pharmacies is to lower costs to patients and the system. I would ask that each of you look into the reality of these savings. Unless PBMs pay different rates to different pharmacies, I'm not sure where the cost savings come from. The PBM determines how much the plans and patients pay. If all plans and patients pay the same, regardless of pharmacy, where would the cost savings come from? Our pharmacies can meet the needs of patients from birth to death, including specialty and long-term care needs. Patients should have the choice to keep all of their medications in one place with a pharmacy team that they trust. If we can meet all the needs of the patient and provide necessary data to the PBM, it seems like the PBM should allow us to continue caring for our patient. I firmly believe that PBMs were started to do good and to contain costs. However, today that's not happening. They need scrutiny and visibility to ensure that the claim processing industry has fair rules of the road, and most importantly, to ensure that patient care is the primary focus. Thank you for this opportunity. I'd be glad to take any questions.
Any questions, member? Well, Mrs. Representative Loeffler.
Well, I just wanted to say thank you for giving some real-life stories in addition to us understanding how the business relationships work. This is really helpful, and thank you for coming on a snowy day to share that.
And I just want to echo the same thing, that I really appreciate hearing the real-life stories of how this is really impacting pharmacies like yourself, but also the patients. One of your, I think, biggest statements that resonated with me that was a little bit shocking is that PBMs, not the doctors, tell the patient they have to change their medication. And I was like, really? You know, they really are making medical decisions for patients. So I just want to say thank you for coming in. I know your grandfather is very proud of you for fighting for not only your own family business, for so many other family businesses trying to survive in on the heels of the PBMs. So thank you so much.
Absolutely. And thank you.
Safe travels. Dr. Valsoni. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Alex Fazzuni, and I'm a family physician practicing just down the road in West St. Paul. I'm a board member with the Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians, and I'm here today at the request of the Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians and the Minnesota Medical Association to offer our strong support for HF 728. So as we've talked a little bit today, but a pharmacy benefit manager is typically a third-party group that creates and maintains a list of preferred medications, often called a formulary. When they first came on the scene, they served an important role of trying to negotiate a lower cost, which would hopefully be passed on to the patient in savings. Today, it's unclear whether they actually offer cost savings to patients. There's no way to review if any of the savings achieved by their bargaining clout is making its way to the patient. That's because there's a complete lack of transparency on what manufacturer prices they're able to obtain, what rebates they're given, and what savings is being passed on to their consumers. There are some that argue that this system is probably increasing the cost to patients. To illustrate, here's just an example of how a drug that could be chosen by a PBM as the preferred drug might not be the best option for a patient. Let's say there are two similar drugs to treat high blood pressure. Drug A costs $100, and the manufacturer is willing to offer the PBM a $40 rebate. Drug B costs $50, and the manufacturer is able to offer the PBM a $10 rebate. Let's say that the PBM keeps 10% of the rebate for themselves and passes the rest of the savings on to the consumer. Drug A is more expensive for the patient, but still offers the PBM a bigger benefit and may have a better chance of making it onto the preferred list of medications. I can tell you that as a physician, it's very frustrating to have outside people influencing the options I can give my patients, particularly when they've been on medications that have worked well for them for a very long period of time. I have many experiences where the preferred drug or the formulary is changed even sometimes halfway through the year, even though it's not a better alternative or a cheaper alternative for the patient. So a patient of mine came in the winter. It was after the first of the year, so she had her new insurance plan. I came in the room. She was crying. She was flat. She came in to finally talk about her mental health, something that had been troubling her for a while. We talked about her options, and she decided she was ready to start medication to see if that would help. We picked a medicine that looked like it was on her formulary. It was generic, so it was going to be affordable for her, and we started it. Medications for mental health take time to start working, so we planned to come back in about 6 weeks and see how she was doing, knowing that she could always call me sooner if she was having side effects or was feeling worse. When she came back in 6 weeks, it was remarkable to see the change that had occurred. She was bright. She was happy. She was tearful again, but this time because she was so joyful, saying, "I didn't know I could feel this way. This is amazing." We planned to leave her on the medication for a while to make sure that she was in a really good place before having a discussion about stopping it. Typically, that's about 6 months. 2 months later, she had called me saying, "I went to refill my medication, and they told me I can't. It's not on my preferred drug list anymore." After a few days of going back and forth with her insurance company and PBM, they had said, "Well, here are the three drugs that are now preferred." My patient was frustrated because we had found a drug that had worked for her and didn't give her side effects. She was so scared to change, and that fear was incredibly apparent. We did go through the plan of trying her on a different medication. She had side effects, unfortunately, about 2 weeks into treatment, so we had to stop that one and change over to a second medication. After about 4 weeks, that one still wasn't effective. We talked about either increasing the dose or trying a new medication. She decided to try the new medication, which was drug number 3 on the formulary list. It still wasn't working for her. We were finally able to appeal to her pharmacy benefit manager and say, "We've tried the 3 drugs you wanted us to try, and they're not working. Her mental health isn't doing well. We've been doing this for about 3 months now." We were finally granted an exception to be able to go back to the original medication that had worked well. There was nothing wrong with the medications that were now listed on her preferred formulary, but there was also no good reason to change away from it. All the drugs were generics. They were all inexpensive. She should have been able to stay on the original medication that had worked well for her, and that was able and available to her starting on January 1st of that year. The mid-year switch in particular was very challenging. I've also had patients who had experiences, too, with the gag clause that we've heard our pharmacists talk about. A patient came to me and said, "Doctor, I'm really worried. I can't afford my high blood pressure medicine anymore. It's costing me $50 a month." She was on a generic blood pressure medication, and I know from experience that that usually runs about $4 to $10 a month. So we looked online at a retail pharmacy website, and we were able to see that if she switched to a different pharmacy, she could simply pay cash, not using her insurance, and get the medication for $10 a month. even going to the current pharmacy she was at, that pharmacy offered a coupon where she'd be able to get it for $14 a month. And that $36 a month meant a lot to my patient. She was able to do that. I don't know if there was a gag clause that was keeping her pharmacist from telling her about the option that she would have had, but I certainly don't want any pharmacist to be limited when they have a chance to offer my patient better care on medications that are effective for them. Please support this bill and allow Minnesotans a chance to be more informed and have more transparency about what kind of costs are being created in their health care. Thank you for allowing me to speak on this issue. I'd be happy to take any questions that you have.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifier. And I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name. Is it Fosuni?
Fosuni.
Okay. Anyway, I just wanted to ask, you know, in your story about your patient, obviously the patient had to come back several times, and it sounds to me like perhaps additional costs were created. Certainly your time was taken up having to deal with these extra visits and contacts and so on. Can you comment a little bit about that? Because it occurs to me that by permitting this kind of jerking around with the medication, that probably your story is one that's just probably repeated many times throughout the system.
Could Macy Vanzoni?
Madam Chair and members, yes, absolutely. For many of the medication adjustments we have to make, whether it's for mental health, for diabetes, there's often increased cost to the patients. They need to take time off work. They need to come see me in the office. Sometimes they have to pay for repeat blood testing to make sure they're tolerating the new medications. Sometimes they need EKGs to make sure the medications aren't affecting their heart rhythms. It's also a lot more time on phone for my staff. Because we are aware of the cost for patients having to come into the office, we do try and manage things appropriately by phone that we can. So my patients play phone tag a lot with my staff to try and say, tell me your last 6 blood sugar readings so we can change the insulin that we just had to change because of the formulary adjustment. There's also a lot of paperwork that goes back and forth between my office and the PBMs. My organization that I work for actually had to create a separate department just to deal with the prior authorization and the paperwork. My assistants were extremely happy that day because each authorization they had to do typically took on average 20 to 30 minutes, and we had to do several every day. And they're trying to accomplish that work while answering phone calls for my patients, rooming my patients, helping my patients navigate around our clinic, and helping to set up follow-up appointments. So perhaps sometimes we'll see a small savings in drug costs by these formulary changes, but there are a lot of other costs that patients and the system in general are incurring because of it.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, thank you so much for your testimony, Dr. Bosuni. Melanie Schrader. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Evening now. I apologize. My name is Melody Schrader, and I represent PCMA. I wanted to tell you all before we get started that you need to be a little alarmed because I was here just a few weeks ago, and it was during the Arctic polar vortex, and so I think I brought with me that 30-degree weather.
Yeah.
And so apparently every time I come to Minnesota, your weather makes national news. I just want you all to know that. My mother called me very early this morning and said, and I quote, "Are you all right?" And I said, "Well, I think so." I said, the planes have been canceled. I said, the airport's closed. Snow's piling up outside. The visibility's very low, but the hotel's wonderful. I did leave my coat on the airplane yesterday, so that did make it a little cold today, but everything's good. But I just want to warn you in advance. If I come back, I don't know what's going to happen because now, as I understand it, you all have now got more snow in February than ever before, thanks to the storm I brought with me today. So just letting you know. Madam Chair, I have a few prepared remarks I'd like to make because this is such a complex issue. I debated even just a few moments ago as I sat over here as to whether or not I wanted to make the prepared remarks or respond to some of the issues that have been raised. But because this is such a complex issue, if you would indulge me just a few moments, I'd like to make some prepared remarks, and then I'd like to answer any of your questions and, of course, address some of the issues that I think have been raised by the previous speakers. So, good afternoon, first of all. And my name is Melody Schrader, and I do represent the Pharmaceutical Care Management Association. That's PCMA. We are the National Association for Pharmacy Benefit Managers, or PBMs. So now I've got all the acronyms out of the way. We administer the prescription drug plans for more than 266 million Americans, with health coverage provided by employers, health plans, federal employee benefit plans, state plans, Medicaid, and Medicare. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today to discuss HF 728. I want to thank the sponsor and the members of this committee for taking the time to meet and work with our industry on this important and comprehensive legislation. We share the sponsor's desire, and I know the members of this committee's desire, that the citizens of Minnesota will have access to critical medications at the lowest cost. PBMs exist to meet specific needs of our clients who pay for the drug benefit. Today, the industry has a 40-plus year track record of clinical and cost management innovation. Initially, PBMs primarily processed claims. But as drugs became more complex, expensive, and an integral part of our healthcare delivery system, our clients asked, and now they demand, tools to manage that part of the benefit. PBMs offer a wide array of services that provide proven tools because our clients have demanded them. These tools are widely recognized as key drivers in lowering prescription drug costs, increasing access, and improving outcomes. If I could, I'd like to pause for just a moment and take a little time to talk about the relationship between the PBM and their client, because it's an important part of the policy discussion that often gets lost in this critical conversation. PBMs are vendors. We have a business-to-business relationship with the entity offering the coverage. Whether it's a large self-insured plan, a labor union, they are the ones that are designing the benefit. They determine how it will be administered. Every detail is outlined in a contract between these two sophisticated entities. These services are procured in a complex and a comprehensive RFP process. With approximately 80 different PBMs in the marketplace, the PBM industry is highly competitive. The plan sponsors have a variety of choices when considering how best to manage the pharmacy benefit. According to the Department of Labor, third-party administrators, or TPAs, such as PBMs, who have no power to make any decisions as to the plan policy, interpretations, practices, or procedures, but who perform administrative functions for an employee benefit plan, are not fiduciaries of the plan. Federal courts have struck down state fiduciary mandates as being preempted by ERISA. There are some areas in SF 278, I'm sorry, 728, that's my dyslexia, where we believe we can find or already have found some agreement. PCMA supports the patient paying the lowest possible price at the point of sale. We support the gag clause prohibition, and we believe medication adherence is critical to a patient's overall health and support medication synchronization section of the legislation. We have also worked in years past with all of the stakeholders on the critical and highly negotiated areas of audit and maximum allowable cost. We continue to support the previously negotiated language. We manage high-cost specialty medications, the fastest-growing segment of the drug spend, and arguably the entire healthcare dollar. This legislation will allow any pharmacy to serve as a specialty pharmacy in a PBM's network without further accreditation. By not allowing PBMs to require any additional accreditation standards above state requirements for licensure, it is falsely assumed that all pharmacies are capable of providing the same level of highly specialized care to the consumers in Minnesota. And again, falsely assumed that any pharmacy has the expertise to dispense these clinically complex specialty drugs. This is simply not true. Not all pharmacies are qualified to offer the same services to consumers. New research shows that only 2% of doctors or specialists who work with specialty pharmacies believe that all drugstores have the expertise and the capability to provide different types of specialty medications to patients. P- PBMs aggregate the buying power of our clients and negotiate discounts from manufacturers of drugs that compete with therapeutically similar brands and generics. These price concessions in the form of rebates negotiated by PBMs on behalf of our plan sponsors significantly lower the cost of drugs. More than 90% of those rebates and discounts are passed on to our clients. The clients then use those funds to lower out-of-pocket cost and or premiums for their members. As a result of the PBM's role in negotiating discounts from manufacturers, PBMs have been able to keep drug costs down. PBMs also lower costs for patients and payers. According to researchers, PBMs help patients and payers save $941 per enrollee per year. That equals about $654 billion over the next 10 years. Plan sponsors use these savings to benefit patients by lowering premiums or deductibles. PBMs save plan sponsors and consumers an estimated 35% compared to expenditures made without a pharmacy benefit manager. For example, PBMs were able to negotiate a savings of more than $400 per pill on the expensive but life-saving Hep C drug. As I mentioned earlier, we rely on our pharmacy network to ensure our clients, beneficiaries, and employees have access to the drug benefit. Independent pharmacies, as you have heard today, are an important part of that supply chain. In order to strengthen their bargaining power and clout in negotiations, 80% of the independent pharmacies hire pharmacy service administration organizations, or PSAOs. I promise, I think that's my last acronym. These PSAOs are companies like AmerisourceBergen, McKesson, and Cardinal Health, and they provide many services to independent pharmacies, including pooled purchasing power, negotiated reimbursement rates, marketing, inventory, and back office services. When a person goes into a pharmacy with a prescription, they often think the drug costs the amount of their copay. But you as policymakers know that isn't the case. The drug manufacturer sets the price of the drug, but a manufacturer doesn't distribute that drug. That is done through a wholesaler. The wholesaler may be the PSAO, and they may work with the PSAO so the pharmacies can purchase drugs for resale. The pharmacies also negotiate rebates and discounts through their wholesaler or PSAO. The pharmacist stocks the drug, and the patient pays his copay, and the PBM, on behalf of our health plan, adjudicates the claim and pays the pharmacy. I know I've been giving a short time to talk about a complex issue, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here today. There are just a couple of issues that were brought up that I want to make sure I clarify. First of all, Maryland does not have a fiduciary requirement. Maine did pass a fiduciary requirement. It was upheld by a lower court in Maine. In the process of us appealing it, it was repealed by the state legislature. It was repealed because PBMs refused to do business in that state because we are not fiduciaries. D.C. passed a fiduciary requirement, and it was struck down by the court. Nevada has passed a fiduciary requirement, but the regs have not gone into effect, and we don't believe it's being enforced at this point. I'm happy to answer any questions that you have. I do want to say that we believe that the independent pharmacies are an integral part of our provider network. They're an integral part of our business. We must have them in order to meet RFP requirements. We are not trying to put them out of business. It was said earlier that in Ohio and Kentucky that those studies showed that we did not pay independent pharmacies fairly. Both of those studies actually showed that independent pharmacies were paid more than chains in both states. So with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions that you have, and I do appreciate your accommodating both my prepared remarks and this late hour.
Thank you so much. I have a question. My question would be, that I'm curious about how the PBMs, how do you position yourself to make decisions about what type of medication patients should be able to use? I mean,
how does the formula come about? Is that what you're asking?
The formula, but let's start with the formula.
Okay, we'll start there. So a formulary is developed at the PBM. It first is done at the clinical level, and so we have pharmacists, doctors, specialists, all sorts of folks. What I will tell you is not on that committee in most instances is financial folks. They look at the drugs, as I think my pharmacist friends who are sitting here today would tell you. There are many drugs in the marketplace. Many of them accomplish the same goal, but they may do it in a different way. So they may not even be a generic equivalent. They're just a therapeutic equivalent. So once the P&T committee, the Pharmacy and Therapeutic Committee, meets and decides that these drugs, you must have so many drugs in so many classes. But once they decide, okay, you can probably, for the vast majority of the patients, you can accomplish the task by using any one of these several drugs. Then they turn it over to the finance folks. And then the finance folks say, on behalf of our clients, again, the employers, the state plans, Medicare, that are paying for the benefit, what is the most economic advantageous selection for that group of people, considering that we can accomplish the goal for every patient in some way? Because as I think was said here today, there is an appeal process. So that is how they develop the formulary. So then you go to, I think, the example that was said today. Okay, so my patient was on a drug and they had to change. I don't know what the circumstances of that situation was. It could have been they changed plans. It could have been they changed employers. It could have been that the formulary changed at that particular moment. We don't know, and I don't think it can be discussed in this particular forum. But there was a change. What I will tell you, in every case, the attempt is to make sure that the initial drugs do the job, and they do them for the vast majority of the people. That is the economic well-being of the plan. And I say they do it for the vast majority of the enrollees. That's for the economic well-being of the plan. Occasionally, one person will not do well on a particular drug, and I think as demonstrated here today, there is a process for moving that patient to another drug and an appeals process that, in fact, works because the patient was able to get that drug.
Thank you for that. It seems like you have, like, lots of stakeholders who are helping to make decisions about that formulary process or what that looks like. And you stated that some of the priorities of the PBMs is to improve outcomes, access,
right,
and the lowest costs. And so I think one of the challenges that we are finding here in the state of Minnesota and probably around the country, that the lowest cost is not always affordable, right? So it's not about affordability. It's more about the lowest cost. And so, you know, as because PBMs are not physicians, they're not, you know, healthcare providers, it's a free market and it's a business. How do you create a process where, you know, I would never have thought that when I went to the doctor was not making decisions about my medication. It was someone else who doesn't know me has made a decision about what is what they believe may be best for me. And so how do a company get to a place where they have that authority that is over, like, the physician of that patient about what is in the best interest of that patient based on the relationship, the medical needs of that patient?
Wow. You ask a lot in that one question. So I'm going to try to break it down and answer those as succinctly as possible. First and foremost, and I think the thing that we know in this country is we have third-party payers, right? So the employer oftentimes is the payer in this case. It could be the state of Minnesota. It could be Medicare. Those are the payers. So when my $10 copay, when I walk into the pharmacy, to me, as a patient, as a constituent, as a citizen of Minnesota, it looks the same, whether I'm at Sterling's, is that right? Sterling's Pharmacy, or if I'm at a Walgreens. That $10 copay to me looks the same. What is different is what stands behind that $10 copay, and that's the employer or the health plan that's paying. So that $10 drug that looks like $10 to me may actually cost $50 here and $55 here. That's the employer that's paying the rest of that drug cost, and it's real dollars to them. So I want to make sure that we understand that there is a payer. When you say, can the patient choose? Yes. I think in the same example that we heard earlier, they were relatively cheap generic drugs. The patient could have walked in and said, I'm just willing to pay cash every day. But we don't expect them to do that because they've got health insurance. We have a third-party payer system. So when we talk about free markets, it's real hard to talk about that in healthcare because healthcare is a really complicated business. So you ask, how does that decision-making process happen? It happens when let's go with an employer because that's an easy one. The employer says, I want to offer benefits to my employees, but I only have a certain amount of dollars to offer that benefit with. So he has to make, or she has to make, some hard decisions. Can we have everything that we want because that's what we want? No, because those dollars are finite. So then you have to start making decisions based on adherence, outcomes, and financial. And I will tell you, the P&T committee looks at outcomes, they look at adherence, then they look at financials. All P&T committees do that. Because what's most important is that we get the patient the right drug at the right time. Now, you have occasionally that one drug doesn't do what you want it to do for that patient. That's why they call it practicing medicine, by the way. The doctor doesn't always prescribe the best course of treatment the first time either. They try their best to do that, and I think the P&T committees do that as well. They try their best to make sure that what is on the formulary does the best job at the right time all of the time. Does it always work? No. Occasionally, we have to have an appeals process. Every PBM, every health plan that I'm aware of has an appeals process, and you can go through that process to get to the drug that your physician wants if the first line of defense didn't work. Did I answer all your questions? Because you had a lot rolled up in that
I
one.
Had another and I one, too. I just can't remember because I didn't write it down. So do any other members have any questions? Okay, Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Mann, for bringing this bill forward. I think all of us care deeply about making drug prices more affordable, and something I heard all the time this fall when I was out campaigning, and it's, I would say, a top priority. And I'd say I agree with so much of what is in this bill, particularly the prescription synchronization, removing the gag clause, and allowing pharmacies to charge the patient the lowest cost across the board, whatever that is. So, you know, I'm very supportive of all of that. I just have a couple questions. First of all, on the formulary thing, forgive the slang, why can it change without warning, and is that addressed by this bill?
Ms. Schrader.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I don't believe the formulary change issues are addressed by this bill. I apologize if it is. I read a lot of bills, but I don't think it is. To why a formulary changes, good question. So a generic may come on the market. That would change the formulary because there's a lower cost alternative in the marketplace. A drug may be found to be less, may not be found to not be safe anymore. That has happened on a couple of occasions. Even there was a drug a few years ago that the PBMs discovered the drug was not working effectively and was actually causing harm to the patients before the FDA figured it out. They removed it from their formularies before the FDA even took it off the market. There could be clinical reasons that the formulary would change. There also could be that there's a new drug that comes out on the that is needed on the formulary. When the Hep C drug came out, it was life-changing. For the first time, these patients had a drug that literally cured Hep C. So that would have probably gone on the formulary. Then the formulary would have changed again within about 6 months because a competing drug came on the marketplace. And once we had two competing drugs, again, they're not the same molecules, but they accomplish the same task. Once we had two competing drugs, we were able to go to those drug manufacturers and ask them to compete for formulary placement. So once they were able to compete for formulary placement, we went from $86,000, which was the original list price, down to about $35,000 today. The formulary changed. Everyone changed their formulary. Not the same Hep C drugs were necessarily on every formulary because the negotiations were different with every PBM. But there was a drug on the formulary that cured Hep C. So those are some examples of why a formulary could change during the year.
Thank you. Madam Chair? Thank you. And one of the goals of all of us is to reduce the costs, and you cited some statistics about how PBMs have reduced costs. I'm just looking for more detail on who did those studies and how is that information available, and is there any information about how they have or have not reduced costs specifically in Minnesota, or how could we learn more about that?
I can provide all of those studies to you, and some of them will have some state-specific information, not all of them, because some of them are federal in nature, but I'll provide all of those to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One more. So unlike Representative Albright, I'm not an expert on ERISA, but long ago in a different life, I worked on ERISA issues quite extensively, but it was a long time ago, so I'm rusty. But I do have ERISA-related concerns to this, just from my foggy memory on the subject. So I just wondered, Representative Mann or one of the other testifiers, if you could just give me a little more sense of where this discussion is going on that piece. Like, are you sticking with the language? Are you still negotiating? Like, how is that playing out as the bill moves forward? Thank you.
This is Representative Mann.
Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Robbins. Yeah, so I am definitely open to continue having that conversation to make sure that we get this bill hammered out and get it as clean as possible before we get it through. So as the bill moves from committee to committee, I'm looking forward to having those conversations with Representative Albright and anyone else who's interested. And to your other question, another reason why the formulary changes, which we didn't touch upon, is because the amount of rebate that the PBM gets from the manufacturer changes. And so that can change a formulary. I have had countless patients I've had to change medications from a generic to a brand name drug because of a formulary change. And I don't know how that happens, since brand name drugs are more expensive than generics, but on their formulary you can only get the brand name drug. So that's something to consider also. And it doesn't happen occasionally, it happens all the time. I had to do 1 to 5 prior authorizations per day in my practice.
All right, Representative Robin, you good? Okay, Chair Liebman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Schrader, I'm not sure if I heard, are you opposed to the fiduciary duty part of the bill?
Yes, ma'am.
Could you explain to us, I'm sorry, Madam Chair and Ms. Schrader, could you explain to us why you don't think that PBM should have a fiduciary duty to the health carrier? And, you know, this seems to me it's a pretty basic thing. You know, a pharmacy benefit manager must perform its duties with care, skill, prudence, diligence, and professionalism. Seems like we all do, right? And then it says a pharmacy benefit manager must exercise good faith and fair dealing in the performance of its contractual duties. That seems like something that doesn't seem too onerous. Why would you be opposed to that?
Ms. Rader.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the good faith and fair dealing, I don't think we oppose that language. It is the issue of the fiduciary. That is a term, as Representative Albright noted earlier, that is specific to the ERISA law. ERISA came into, you did an excellent job of giving the history of ERISA. ERISA came into being, if I recall correctly, because Studebaker went out of business, their pensions were failing, people had been promised a benefit, no longer had it. And that is why ERISA came into existence. That's why fiduciaries exist within ERISA. The FTC, the Department of Labor, the Justice Department, I think all of them have chimed in and said that PBMs as a B2B contract for the health plan is not conducting fiduciary responsibilities. And I will tell you that I am not an ERISA expert, even though I do have some background in ERISA, and I am not an expert on fiduciaries. But what I will tell you is that a fiduciary is oftentimes, let's say I'm I'm controlling my grandmother's estate, and so I am using those funds for her benefit. So I have to be a fiduciary because I have to be responsible for her well-being. In a health plan, we're taking and aggregating the monies of all of the beneficiaries for the well-being of the group. So we are going to be making payments and et cetera, but it's for the group. So there might be a decision occasionally where, like in utilization review, where we say you're going to have to try another drug before you can get that drug. I know that's an unpopular thing to say in front of this group, but that's the reality. That is what happens because of the expense of that drug and who's paying that for that drug. And so, therefore, if we were to be a fiduciary, we would not be able to do that, which is what saves our clients money. And again, we work for our clients, which are the employers, the health plans, the state plans, Medicare, Medicaid, union plans. And so it is a definition within ERISA, and it holds a lot of it's just a very detailed thing. I don't think we can go into it here, and I'm going to tell you it's way out my bailiwick.
Well, Madam Chair.
Good evening. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I guess I was confused about the conversation before because I don't see ERISA in this. I don't know why this is all about ERISA, first of all. But, you know, if you're working, if a health plan or the state or whoever it is hires a PBM to manage its pharmacy benefit, you're supposed to be managing that benefit under a contract with that payer for the benefit of that payer and that payer's patients. And notwithstanding what you just said, I really don't see why you shouldn't have a duty to act as a fiduciary to make sure that, you know, and I realize the definition of fiduciary can be different in different situations, but it seems kind of maybe this needs a little tweaking, but it sure sounds like, you know, when you're hired to, say, save costs for the enrollees in a plan, that should be the thing that you should be doing, not making extra money from this one and this one and bringing it together, and, you know, which seems to be kind of the way the business model is working, but making sure that you're actually reducing prices for the people who are served. So, I just don't get it where we're having a problem with that. I still have the floor, Madam Chair, I just want to say, too, and this is not related, but just to Representative Mann, I got a text from one of our members, Representative Hamilton, and he says, tell Representative Mann, great job and stay strong. So I just wanted to convey that on the record because Representative Hamilton would be saying that if he was sitting here. Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and everyone connected to healthcare has wrestled with growing costs and the challenges of that. And I can see where someone who runs a health plan or is a health plan would want to try and figure out how do we get quantity discounts, how do we get the best deals so that we can keep our premiums stable, keep our costs low. And I think that was the original concept, was to have somebody who's really an expert and can figure out what's going on in a constantly changing pharmacy environment, advise them, be an intermediary and trying to keep up on what's the newest things and what isn't. But it all falls apart in the current realm when patients have to go repeatedly back to a physician, go through additional lab tests, as we were told. It doesn't work. It compromises their health for months on end, which may threaten their employment. Not everybody, in fact, surprisingly large number of people do not have paid sick leave, so they're threatening their job the more that they have to deal with those kind of things. It doesn't allow the employer, who usually is the payer for the health plan or the third party, to have a consistent, productive workforce. It frustrates people and it discourages people from going into medicine where they really want to be the person who is helping people address their health challenges in the most beneficial way possible so that they can maintain good health and a quality life as long as possible and hopefully overcome some really serious challenges. And so if I were a large employer and trying to run a health plan for my employees, I have no interest at all in contracting with someone who is going to make, for maybe it's 15, maybe it's 20%, 10% of my patients incur additional costs, additional visits, additional tests, quality of life issues, productivity issues. And the only reason I think that they stay with it is the razzle-dazzle of the rebate system, where the PBM can say, you know, based on us putting together you with all the other large employers, we're able to get this gigantic discount, and trust us, we're getting you always the lowest cost. And the cost of the drug is such a small part of what the real patient outcome is. And I personally know of two constituents whose life permanently has been altered because of a forced change in medication, with very fragile health conditions, and who had very, very stable lives up till that point. One had resulted in permanent brain damage and disability because of an inability to control a rare form of epilepsy. And another who had early in life had to give up her professional career for schizophrenia, had found a drug that had stabilized her for decades. And she was forced to change into something else. She got off the bus on the way to work one day because she was so suicidal. She knew she needed some help. She went into inpatient psychiatric hospitalization for over 2 weeks and is still riding the roller coaster of trying to get back to just having a stable life like she'd had for decades. And thankfully, she's got an employer who's hanging in there with her. And, you know, that is a huge, huge price for any individual to pay. But it's also a huge price for the employers who are paying the premiums. And it just feels to me like, you know, the 80-20 rule works in most things. And, you know, maybe you have to have 20% exceptions, and qualified doctors, like the author here, can say this isn't working and override a rigid system that doesn't work for a substantial number of patients. But the lack of flexibility is what's led us to saying we have to step in on behalf of the patients and on behalf of the employers and the payers, because the system isn't working currently. And we'd welcome your input into how to improve that system, but right now this is the best we've got, because it's not working for a substantial number of people, and it's jeopardizing the cost effectiveness, the efficiency, and the patient outcomes of individuals. And it's working against all the goals that we have of trying to get people access to affordable, quality coverage.
Anyone wants to respond to that, or you don't have to? Okay. Representative Pearson.
Nice little microphone. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm in talking about the fiduciaries that Representative Chair Liebling was bringing up, and in your testimony, we had a lot of discussion about that fiduciary aspect of things and how it's been, not very successful in standing up in court in some other states. And then there was one state, I think it was Maine, that you mentioned that it just ended up not being implemented because the PBMs all pulled out of the market. And Madam Chair, if I can just ask, was that Maine that it happened in? So if this bill, as it stands now, moved forward and was held up in what was upheld in court, went forward, everything's green light on it, passed into law, would you anticipate there'd be a similar reaction in Minnesota that PBMs would leave the state of Minnesota as a practical matter?
Mrs. Strider, and why?
I'm sorry.
Mrs. Strider, I just ate it, and why?
Oh, yes, thank you. So it was Maine that it. So what happened in Maine, it was passed, this was years ago. The bill was challenged in court. It was upheld by a lower court. We were in the process of challenging it when the legislature decided itself to repeal it. And the reason was when health plans, employers, et cetera, went out with this RFP process. And, again, I appreciate your comment about the patients, but we want those patients to be on the right drugs at the right time, and we want them to be adhered to those drugs, but it is the employer that's paying for it and our clients, and so they do have responsibilities that they ask for us to do. What happened in Maine, and what I suspect could happen here, is when those RFPs are put in the marketplace, you will find that few to none of the PBMs will actually respond to them because of their obligations and what the obligations of the term fiduciary means.
Madam Chair.
Representative Pearson.
Yeah, so if that happened, then who then takes on that role of the PBM? Is it the insurance companies then directly that would have to fulfill that? There'd be a vacuum, there'd be a void in our current market, and I guess even more so, what would you anticipate the outcomes would be in that circumstance?
So what happened in Maine, I'm so sorry, Madam Chair, please forgive me. I apologize, and I promised myself I wouldn't do that. So what happened in Maine is that they were able to evergreen contracts so that they didn't have to put out new RFPs. And then they were able to maintain the business continuity until such time that the legislation was repealed. But I don't see that that necessarily is the case here because I don't see any allowances for that in your bill.
Madam Chair, you used the term evergreen, and admittedly, I don't know if I know. I think I can leap to a conclusion of what evergreening a contract could mean. But could you clarify that?
So what you're going to have to give me a bail or something. What would happen is if there was an existing contract and then they could just continue that business relationship, then the PBM and the health plan or the employer or the labor union, whatever, would continue that relationship without changing the terms and conditions of the contract, therefore be able to evergreen that contract. I don't see that possibility. That was in the main bill. I don't see that in your bill. Oftentimes it'll say, you know, new or renewed contracts, and I don't think that that's in your current legislation.
Ms. Schrader, what is evergreen the contract?
So that means that it would just, the existing contract would continue.
It would continue.
And
Representative Pearson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so beyond the fiduciary aspect of this bill, there's not a lot that you object to, and I guess my question would be for the author of the bill, if that's something that, again, I know the language is something we're still massaging and working with, but is that fundamental principle just kind of the overarching? Because this is the Health Policy Committee, and again, the impacts on access and the ability to provide pharmaceuticals to, you know, hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans would be in jeopardy, and I guess that's a significant issue that I think this committee should be dealing with.
Madam Chair.
Representative Mann.
Thank you. Representative Pearson. So I don't think it's overarching as it stands, but again, we are definitely open to conversation and to make sure that language is correct. Other states have done it. It's been held, or it's passed through court. It's been voted in favor of the law as it's written. And the other thing is that whenever we talk about oversight of any industry, like we had this conversation about pharmaceutical companies the other day, about price gouging and manufacturers, and the threat is always, well, we're all going to leave the state then. We're not going to be here anymore. And that's never happened, as far as I know, ever. So it's just, you know, it's one of those big things that gets said, which I don't particularly put much clout in. And lastly, in the event that PBMs leave the state of Minnesota, like we're seeing in the other states, we'd probably save millions of dollars. Look at West Virginia.
Representative Pearson. Okay. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be quick. I want to apologize. I missed quite a bit of this because there was another committee hearing, and so my apologies if this is especially stupid or or missed something that was said earlier, but I just wanted to support Representative Mann's point about the potential impact if this passes. There was a opinion of a North Dakota court last year upholding a similar law in North Dakota. It's true that there were laws in Iowa and Arkansas that had been struck down previously, and I think the North Dakota court was recognizing some of the changes, some improvements along the way, and I think we probably are learning from that. But I just want to point out that the appeal from the Arkansas case has been joined by a number of other states who presumably are all working to do this. And those states include California, Colorado, Connecticut, Delaware, Georgia, Hawaii, Idaho, Indiana, Iowa, Kansas, Kentucky, and I guess I'll stop, but there's more than 30 states. So it's hard for me to believe that PBMs are going to exit every one of those states because they all are joining in this work and all really pushing this. So I guess we are not alone in doing this, and I think that bolsters Representative Mann's point that that doing this, if all these other states are doing this too, I don't think that there's such a significant danger, and it's quite a long list of states here. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I guess I'm not concerned that PBMs are going to exit the state, and if they do, I think it we're going to see health plans taking over much of the duties that PBMs were conducting in terms of looking at the effectiveness of drugs, efficacy, and total cost of care, because pharmacy spend has increased so significantly. Health plans want to manage that pharmacy spending, and they're hiring experts in pharmacy PhDs to look at their pharmacy spending and try to manage it and put together their own formularies. So I think health plans in Minnesota will fill some of that gap if we do see PBMs exiting, which I don't think we will see. But I 100% support the bill. I think we need to have more oversight. I think when we thought PBMs could come into this healthcare arena and save money by negotiating, but they're now taking advantage of these discounts and not passing that on to consumers and possibly affecting quality of care when consumers are not getting the appropriate medication, and then adding additional costs to providers to have to spend time to get approval for different drugs that are on the formulary. So thank you, Representative Mann, for bringing this forward.
All right. I think we're going to move to
Madam Chair, may I say, first of all, you may be 100% correct in that the PBMs will not leave Minnesota. I do not want to speculate on that, and I want to make sure that I say that is a possibility, but I want to make sure that I address your issue. I believe you are correct. To the point of many of the states that have been adjoined to that lawsuit, most of them did not deal with the and fiduciary is not the only issue in this bill. There's some others, and we would very much welcome the opportunity to work on the language. I want to make sure that's very clear as well. We have had the opportunity to sit down, not me personally, but those in the industry with you, as well as many others in the committee. And we would welcome that opportunity to do so as well. With the North Dakota lawsuit, I don't recall that fiduciary was part of that. The lawsuit that has been adjoined, you are correct. Not all of it deals with some of the aspects of this bill, but not necessarily the fiduciary aspect. And we are awaiting, as you know, the U.S. Supreme Court to decide if they want to take that up. So to your point, I think you are correct. PBMs came into existence to help employers navigate this complicated field. They do not have to use us. They choose to use us. And so with that, I appreciate your comment, and I think you're 100% correct.
Thank you so much for your testimony. I really appreciate
you
going through the question.
And thank you for your patience.
Thank you. Yeah. My next testifier is Bitley Graves. Welcome to the committee, and please reintroduce yourself again.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good evening again. I guess now it's evening before it's afternoon, but thank you for having me back. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Bentley Graves. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. A couple things. One, your attention was drawn earlier in the hearing to a letter that was submitted by both the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce and the Minnesota Business Partnership, and one of the statistics was highlighted in that, and I wanted to clarify. In that second paragraph, it talks about the cost-saving role that PBMs play on behalf of plan sponsors, and uses a statistic about, in 2016, brand drug prices increased by 9.2%. But net pharmacy benefit manager customers' prices only grew by 3.5%. And there's a suggestion made that the reason for that was because of generics. But I just wanted to clarify that data was taken from a May 2017 study, and it is comparing only brand pricing. So it has nothing to do with generics. It was an independent study as well. There's some discussion about studies and industry funding. It was an independent study. There's no government or industry funding attached to it. And I'm happy to provide that if folks have that question, but just wanted to kind of clarify that it doesn't have anything to do with generics. It is indeed the difference in brand pricing, largely due in the study sites, largely due to the negotiating of PBMs on behalf of plan sponsors. So just wanted to clarify that. And you can also see in the letter, this bill does a number of things, and some of those were mentioned about gag clauses, about clawbacks, about synchronization, about substitution, many of which would address some of the concerns and issues raised in various pieces of testimony this evening. And that follows on a conversation that we've been having here at the legislature for several years about the role that PBMs play in this, in the process on behalf of plan sponsors, on behalf of employers. And there's been a number of changes, including a pretty substantial step therapy bill last session. And in many respects, this bill builds on some of that. There are two pieces of this bill, though, that we have particular concern about. Again, all those things, the other piece of the bill that it addresses, are not our concern in this realm, but two pieces that we have concerns about are this fiduciary piece that was discussed, as well as the section of the bill that would limit use of mail order pharmacies or specialty pharmacies or brick and mortar pharmacies that a PBM may have an ownership interest in. Those concerns are detailed in the letter. I can certainly go into those if you'd like, but I think they've also been discussed at length. I did want to say that I've had the chance to meet briefly earlier this week with Representative Mann and discuss some of the language in the bill and look at the way that the language is put together and offer some suggestions about maybe how to move pieces of this bill forward to get at some of the concerns without triggering some of the concerns around fiduciary and the implications that has and similar suggestions that we've made with regard to the ownership interest piece. So I look forward to continuing to work with her and the author and the other body on this. Like I said, I'm happy to answer questions if there are some, but I know the letter is here and it's a late night, so I don't want to drag this on any more than we have to. So, but I appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, too. We appreciate that. So is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify to House File 728? Okay, any further discussion from members? Chair Liebman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we should have a roll call on this bill.
Okay. A roll call has been requested. All in favor say aye.
What? Nope.
Oh, okay. All right. The clerk to take the roll on the bill.
Chair Moran?
Yes.
Vice Chair Morrison?
Yes.
Minority Lead Keel? Representative Albright? Representative Backer? Representative Bonner? Representative Edelson? Representative Fisher?
Yes.
Representative Freiberg?
Yes.
Representative Liebling?
Yes.
Representative Loeffler?
Yes.
Representative Mann?
Yes.
Representative New? Representative Pearson?
No.
Representative Pinto?
Yes.
Representative Robbins.
No.
Representative Schumacher.
No.
Representative Schultz.
Yes.
Okay, there being 9 ayes and 4 noes, the motion prevails. House File 728. Oh, okay.
I just wondered where the bill's going.
House File 728 is recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Commerce.
Thank you.
So I just want to thank everyone, including the testifiers, for driving in on such a terrible day. But also sticking with us to complete all the bills. I want to thank members for being present and being here and having such a good debate on all 4 bills. Thank you so much. The committee is adjourned.